Good morning.
Profit margin, no doubt.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly. We're going to call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water.
And also we're calling to order the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Good morning. And I see that Senator Johnson is here as well, and you are welcome to join us up at the dais if you would like.
Unless Madam Chair, I'm just using folks here as targets of opportunity.
Okay. I see that. Well, thank you for being with us this morning.
I think we'll jump right in. We have a long agenda together. We're scheduled for a break at 10 o'clock, and then I think
we're being booted out.
Dingfelder, your committee carries on in a different room while we stay here. Thank you for being here. We are going to start with about 45 minutes on ocean issues. Actually, we'll spend longer than that on ocean issues. But to start, I had asked our colleague, Representative Cowan, to talk a little bit about what's happening on the Central Coast and to bring some of her constituents and colleagues to brief us on work there, in particular related to the decision by NOAA and to move its activities to Newport. So we're very eager to hear about the status of that project as well as other activities on the Central Coast. So come on up, Gene.
Thank you.
Yes, and I should mention, we're jumping right in here without introductions, but I think we'll do that. But I do want to mention that Representative Smith is on the phone, not able to be here in person today. Actually, maybe able, but we're glad he's not here because he's quite sick. So thanks for being on the phone, Jefferson. We hope he's on the phone.
Are you there?
We may have lost him.
Or maybe not.
We'll go ahead and start and try to find a way to get Representative Smith in.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for having us this morning. For the record, I am Jean Cowan. I represent House District 10, and I am very proud to represent the Central Oregon Coast. Always have been, and at this point in time, it's a very exciting place to be. So we really appreciate the opportunity that this committee has, these committees jointly, to the co-chairs, have presented this opportunity for us to highlight some of the things that are going on, not just in District 10, but on the coast of Oregon, and that are so important for the entire state. This is a very exciting time in marine research. And so I wanted to take the opportunity this morning to sort of lay out some of the whole scope of marine-related issues that, and to remind you, first of all, before we get into the exciting part with the experts that I'm going to turn this over to remind you a little bit of some of the legislation that we did pass in 2009 and what that has done for us, the way that we've been able to roll some things into some very exciting progress. First of all, we spent just a small amount of money in some excess new Carissa funds. Once they finally got that Hulk off the beach, there was about $4 million left over, and we said, you know, that really needs to go to the coast. And I think that this legislative effort has allowed that money to be extremely helpful for the entire state. I certainly want to mention House Bill 3013, which established a process for developing a series of marine reserves, and you're going to hear more from Ed Bowles right after we finish, so I'm not going to go into detail on that, but it was an opportunity to bring some consensus to the table and to begin a process that I think will be very beneficial to all of us. We also put a little bit of that funding into the Oregon Nearshore Research Task Force, and those recommendations of individuals for that have been made. That is almost formed and will begin meeting the 1st of December, or 2nd of December, I believe. Their charge is to make recommendations to ensure the protection and utilization of Oregon's nearshore resources. And I think that exciting work will come out of that task force. With House Bill 2098, we put $1.23 million of that new Carissa money into seafloor mapping, and that has already leveraged $5 million with more to come. We have been able to have folks at sea almost continuously since July 25th, and they've got just an incredible amount of data now that they're going to spend the winter putting into actual maps. From the 5% of the territorial sea that we had mapped going into this effort, we anticipate about 45% will be finished with this effort alone. And they're anticipating some additional funding that will take us a little bit outside of the territorial sea line. We have an update underway on the territorial sea plan. And, you know, that's really exciting to me because when we started talking about marine reserves, wave energy, wind energy, a whole scope of things, we said, come on, let's look at everything that we need to do out there and to maintain our industries that are vital to our communities, and let's put it all together in a rational manner. And that's what we're working towards. The fishing industry has stepped up. They're working on some fisheries mapping, so we'll know where the hot spots are that we don't want to compromise. And I'm proud to say that there's a fish film coming out very soon. I was able to preview it recently. I just keep telling them, please just get this to me. They've taken wonderful footage of Oregon coastal waters, our fisheries. They show the gear. They show how they've made adjustments in the gear. There's undersea footage of how the little fishies escape so that only the shrimp stay in this particular net. It's really an incredible piece of work, history, and I'm very excited that that will hopefully be on your desk soon. So lots of really cool stuff is going on, but the wave energy I'm not touching on because Representative Boone is bringing that to you later. There's lots of challenges out there and certainly successes. And here is the personification of our success this year with our sincere thanks to the legislature for the support that they gave to the project to bring the what we like to call the NOAA home port. It's MOCP, Marine Operations Center Pacific. To Newport and the Port of Newport's effort to make that happen, and they're here to tell you their story this morning. So I would like to introduce the Port Manager, Don Mann, and President of the Board of Commissioners for the Port of Newport, Jenny Garblish.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Callum, and Chairman Cannon, other members of the committee.
And why don't you turn the mic, just point, it doesn't have to be close to your mouth, but
all right.
Fine.
Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present this morning and talk a little bit about our project that we're working on. But I'd like to thank...
Please introduce yourself as well.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Don Mann, again, General Manager of the Port of Newport. And the project we're going to talk about today, is, as Gene said, is the Marine Operations Center Pacific. But I want to thank the 2009 legislature for their support for this project, because without your assistance, and especially our Coastal Caucus and their hard work in bringing this to your attention and supporting it for the commitment of the funds to assist with offsetting the costs of this development.
And I'm Jenny Goblersch, and I would just like to say how proud I am of this state, because I'm sure you've been reading some of the comments in the newspapers coming out of Washington, and basically they were humiliated because they made it fairly easy for Oregon to shine in this process, and we did because we have so much to offer. And So the appeal that's going on now will be finished by early December, and basically there's nothing there. There's nothing to worry about, let's put it that way. The only place where I might be concerned would be shenanigans in Congress.
Politics,
right. But not the process. A process was very clean and above board and something to be very proud of. So,
the rendering you see in the top left photo there is a photograph of the South Beach area in Newport, just east of the bridge. A lot of you are probably familiar with that. And it depicts the location of the new 1,500-foot pier, and this is just west of the Oregon State University ship operations, and you can see the stern of the Wacoma there on the left side of the picture. This is an aerial overall view of the South Beach Peninsula and area of South Beach, and you see in red there, that is the site of the new project. This is a closer view. This is the actual development site. Some of you are familiar with South Beach. You know that this was a salmon ranch at one time where Hauser operated this facility. And in ensuing years after that, the port had some projects there, raising some coho for release, and then Chinook as the years went by. At this point, the buildings you see outside the red line there on the right or to the west is the Aquinnah Bay Fruit Processing, which that operation will continue and has been very successful. The most everything you see within that red line will be demolished and leveled, and we'll start fresh. We're putting together at this point. We have hired a contractor at this point. It's Anderson and West Coast Contractors. It's a joint venture, and we've also hired a project manager, Day CPM, out of Beaverton. All the folks so far, the vendors, consultants, nearly all of them, are affiliated or are located in Oregon or in our region. So the biggest challenge for the project, and we've met with all the agencies and are having ongoing discussions, is going to be the permit process and mitigation for the project as far as where the new pier will be located. This again is a larger picture of the rendering. The upland site will consist mainly of the main administration office, which is on the left side of the upland site there, and also the warehouse and other backup facilities, which will lead straight out to the pier. Like I said, the pier is 1,500 feet long. There's two access points, one to the east, one to the west, and then there's a small boat dock, as you can see there on the east side of the east access ramp. If you have any questions while we're going along, please just jump right in. The activities to date, and just to kind of give you a little bit of history of where we started, just about a year ago, and we're at the point now, like I said, we have our contractors in place, our engineers, and the original offer was due February 4th of this year, and the final revised proposal was submitted on June 4th, and we received notification of award on August 4th. We had the lease signed by August 5th. We didn't waste any time. And we did that for a good reason, of course. The three offerers to the north of us, we knew they were not going to be happy once we heard that we received the award, and NOAA wanted to move ahead very quickly, and we did. We had our first kickoff meeting with all our team and consultants, engineers, and project manager on August 20th, and then we had followed up with an all-regulatory agency meeting on August 27th. We've gone out of our way to make sure that we stay in contact with the agencies because we know this is going to be the biggest challenge as far as the project, as I mentioned earlier, for the permits. But everything right now is on schedule. It's on time, within budget. And we'll talk a little bit more about the budget, but the total budget is about $40 million for this project. And the a portion of that will be through a lease revenue bond, which we are working on. And then, of course, as I spoke about, the legislature assisting with lottery bonding. And both of the bond sales will occur at approximately the same time. The state bond sale will be on December 10th, which is real close to our sale date. And funds from the revenue bonding will all be available just before Christmas. So we're moving ahead as the schedule has been presented by our team, and the contractor that I spoke of, Anderson West Coast Contractors, we are doing a CMGC. A CMGC is a construction manager, general contractor, and this is a process where you have the opportunity to have your contractors and your engineers do value engineering together and make sure that the project does stay on schedule, and you do everything you can to stay within budget. and there'll be a guaranteed maximum price for the project, which once we have that construction guarantee, we'll move ahead, and that's the beauty of the CMGC. Once you have that guaranteed maximum price, you work within that budget to make the project stay on track. So we advertised for the CMGC in September. We had the pre-proposal meeting just a little over a week later, and the proposals were due October 6th, the interviews the 21st, and we did a selection on the 22nd. So as you can see, we have a very compressed schedule for this project, and we're very happy that we're being able to stay on the schedule. And we had the pre-construction agreement signed with our CMGC on November 2nd, and we had a two-day meeting on the design eco-charrette of the facility, the Upland facility. So everything is, we have ongoing weekly meetings with our team and also with the agencies every other week just to keep everybody up to speed what's going on with the project. The facility is, the administration office I talked about is a two-story LEED certified administrative office building. The large visitor parking lot and secured staff parking. The warehouse is a single story. There are shops, a boat shed, contractor building, hazardous material building, guard station at the entrance. This will be a completely secured area, be fenced around the perimeter of the facility and check-in point at the main entrance. Each of the berths, the 1,500-foot pier, each of the berths are 260 feet long, and the minimum depth for the ships is 24 feet, and it goes as deep as 28 feet. There'll be quite a few site improvements, which include the paving of the parking lots, curbing, sidewalks, the chain-link fence around the perimeter, all native landscaping, and NOAA is bringing with them a totem pole, which we had to make accommodations for, and there'll be a cover. And when we get done, I'll show you the photo again and show you where the totem is going to go. This is very important to NOAA. It's a tradition that they've carried on for many years that they've had at Lake Union. It sets in front of their facility, and I can't tell you the whole story on it, but it's something that had to be part of the project. This is kind of a layout of the overall site, again, where the office building will be, the warehouse, parking lots, and the main entrance is there to the right of the photo, and that's where the guard shack will be. You see our architects, if anybody's familiar with Glass Architects, Jim Lewis is the key architect, lead architect for us, and they're doing a wonderful job. They recently finished up the Oregon Coast Community College campuses on the Central Coast as well. This is some elevations of what the buildings could look like. The concrete, glass, metal roof, and it just gives you kind of an idea what the construction will appear to look like. The timeline's upcoming. Demolition grading plan will be completed in December, and we'll start work and breaking ground, actually doing work on site probably by the end of December, early January, and construction period will be between April 10th and May of 2011. May of 2011 is when the lease expires at their Lake Union facility in Seattle. And we have to have the administration office and Upland sites completed by that time. Permit process is ongoing, and as I mentioned, it's one of our biggest challenges for the project, and that is ongoing. And we have, as you can see there, a lot of alphabet soup, and we already have, we're working on submitting our JPA. We have our first DEQ permits, which is the 1200C, and also our NPDES permit has been submitted and is up for public comment at this time. And also we're working on our stormwater runoff plan, which will be part of the civil work of our engineer.
It's about done.
Pier construction, we have to do it within the in-water work window, and that's November through February. And once we have the in-water work, we can we'll put the decks on top of the piling, but that's not considered in-water work. So we'll be able to work outside that window once we have all the piling in place. We have to accomplish a LEED certification for the project, and that's on the buildings, and that's up to our architects and engineers for us to meet that. And again, that'll be part of the overall project. We'll actually get the LEED certification after the facility is occupied. The project does bring a lot of economic benefits. When we were talking with our legislators and our Coastal Caucus during the session this year, we talked about some of these economic benefits. And the over the 20-year lifespan of the lease, as you can see, up to $400 million return on investment. The state bond amount was 19.5. The revenue, lease revenue bonds, 25.75 million. The income tax benefit just for the 65 administrative jobs over the 20-year period benefit back to the state is a little over $8 million. The relocation of the research and ship crews. Not all the ship crews, of course, will relocate to the coast. Some will stay in other areas. They may stay in the Sound area, and they come from different places. It depends on what projects are being worked on at the time. We don't anticipate that we'll ever have all six vessels at the docks at one time because they spend over 200 days a year at sea. And so it may not be unrealistic to see two, maybe three, but probably never six unless it's a special occasion. Over the course of the location in the 50 or plus years that they have been in the Lake Union, Seattle area, they have 1,400 vendors that are associated with that facility that cater to the NOAA operation. What this also brings is significant federal investment to Lincoln County and to Oregon, which we haven't seen for a long time, and this is a great opportunity for Oregon and for the region. We'll see exponential growth in the research-based businesses opportunities for the Central Coast, working with the Hatfield Marine Science Center and Oregon State University, which was some of the key points that we brought to the table in our offer to NOAA. There'll be growth of the shoreside businesses, and it'll enhance the likelihood of continual U.S. Army Corps of Engineers dredging for Yaquina Bay and work on our jetties over the ensuing years. There also, this project is enhancing the governor's commitment to ocean health, green industry, and for thriving waterfronts. Again, working with OSU, Oceanographic and Fisheries Research, Hydrographic Surveys, and Ocean Mapping, which Representative Cowan mentioned earlier. Again, the LEED Silver construction requirement, environmentally sensitive ship operations. It's just a world-class enhancement of the existing research presence for Yaquina Bay and for Oregon. Worldwide recognition in ocean research, you know, that's going to be key for growth on the Oregon coast. There'll be a lot of spinoff from this project, and we're really looking forward to the project to not only provide the essential economic growth, but new stable family wage jobs. That's it on the NOAA project. I'll answer any questions.
I would just like to add that this project is requiring, as Don said, a great deal of close coordination and communication with our state permitting agencies. And ODFNW is pretty much taking the point on that and being of direct assistance to us as we prepare our documents and biological assessments and things like that. Extraordinary amount of help, great help to us and to this project. The major challenges are going to be the in-water work and the timeline that NOAA wants. Those are our two big challenges. And so we really appreciate the state agencies have really stepped up to the plate and made this a priority. So
We have about 15, 20 minutes left. I know we got started late, and we do want to hear from OSU as well. Representative Boone has a question.
Quick question, yeah. Hi, Don. Jenny. Hi. Last September, after the OWET, Oregon Wave Energy Trust conference in Seaside, I sent a couple of Norwegians packing your way who provide breakwater and energy devices. Yes. Were you able to?
I did. I spoke with them and okay. We exchanged information. And okay. They do want to. They didn't have time to do a lot of research while they were down there. But we will meet again.
Okay.
And,
good.
So I got their contact information and thank you for that.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Jensen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what you hear in relationship to the Washington appeal on this?
Yes, as Commissioner Gobrich mentioned earlier, the appeal process is ongoing. There are no more findings that can be submitted at this time. The GAO office, Government Accounting Office in Washington, D.C., the appeal is about the process, the challenge of the process NOAA used. And the appeal is not particularly against Newport or the site. It's about the process mainly, and the deadline for finalizing that appeal is December 7th, and we're waiting to hear from the Government Accounting Office on their final comments on the submission of any appeals made by mostly Bellingham, and the other is the private landowner at Lake Union.
And the port did engage the services of attorneys in Washington, D.C., who are paying close attention to it. But so far, nothing has come out of the documents that we've seen that are of concern.
Any questions from the Senate?
Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the monthly rental amount, and when do they start paying it?
I have to do the math real quick. It's $2.53 million per year. And most of that revenue will be dedicated back to the lease revenue bonds. And so it's, and when we submitted our offer, we had the highest technical offer and the lowest lease rate we submitted. But the annual lease rate for the entire facility is $2.53 million.
And the length of the lease?
20 years.
Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. The comments in response to Representative Bent's question, I didn't quite understand. Highest technical, but lowest lease rate. Could you say just a little more about that?
Yes, when we were in the process of submitting our offer, after our first session or pre-construction session with NOAA, when we received and answered the first phase of the solicitation, after we submitted our pre-offer, we were asked to come back to the short list, and we had another meeting with NOAA. And what they did for each of the offers is they talked about the strengths and weaknesses of each of the offers. And the one of the things that they stressed very clearly was that that NOAA and the federal government had a ceiling for the lease rate, annual lease rate of $2.66 million that has been appropriated for this project and for the new lease. So we took that very serious, and we went back. And then we knew that we had to, and that's when we came back and decided to ask the legislature for assistance in this project. But we knew that we couldn't take on the full $40 million and keep that lease rate down below that ceiling. So in an effort to do that, we started our lobbying process and educating our legislators about the benefits of this project. So by doing that, we were able to get under that ceiling, that 2.66. And when the other offers that were there and had that, not in the same room, each we had individual meetings, but they went through the same questions. And when the offers came back, it was ourselves and Port of Port Angeles that did come under that ceiling, and of the 2.66. The others were far above that. And so getting back to my comment about the lowest lease rate, there was two offers below that ceiling. The rest were above, and then all of the other grading on the offer, ours came in on the highest technical side. So it was they weighted it with points, and so that's where it came from.
Thank you. I simply misunderstood the earlier comment. Now
okay.
I get it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Great. Well,
thank you very much. We'll do a little shift here. You know, I was actually literally on my boat in the Puget Sound when the call came from the port saying that they had been successful. I couldn't have picked a better spot. I just can't emphasize enough how many smiles I see in my community for the first time in a very long time, but the benefit that this project is going to bring to the entire state of Oregon. Working with our local businesses, we're helping them understand how to contract with the federal government. This is going to be a huge boon all the way around, and I take a great deal of pride in the community effort that went into putting this together, as well as the fact that the state of Oregon, unlike the state of Washington, was willing to step up and be participatory in making this happen so that we can reap the benefits of the big project. I would mention that on one of the slides it showed the aquarium, it showed the Oregon Coast Community College, it showed Hatfield Marine Science Center. They're all there on that peninsula, and so it's not an accident that this happened in terms of the research and those sorts of efforts that have been going on for a very long time, which is why I'm excited to bring George Bullard here, and who is working on his presentation, to talk a little bit about the breadth and scope of the marine research that's happening through Oregon State University, through the Hatfield Marine Science Center, and the other associated agencies that are located at that facility. It is not a stretch to say that the work that's being done here is of worldwide significance. We bring researchers from all over the world. We're going to bring more. And that's the reason that I wanted to kind of pull this whole presentation together with what's going on at the Marine Science Center as well. Sitting next to me is George Bullard, the director of the Hatfield Marine Science Center. And are we ready to go?
Good morning.
Thank you.
We seem to have some problems with the presentation, but hopefully it's going to come up. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, and thank you, Representative Cowan. The announcement of NOAA coming to Newport has been a real boon for our community, and the community really pulled together under the leadership of the Port of Newport to bring this off. But there's a great deal of... something is going slow here. It doesn't seem... It says it's opening. Okay, yeah. So, presentation now. Okay. Sorry about that, the delay. But there's a great deal of excitement from the research and science community about what this means to Newport. And part of the goal here is to discuss some of that information with you. I'd like to give you a little bit of background on the HMSC, because we are a different organization than most people are aware of. Some of the new developments, and then some of the major initiatives that are going on that are clearly pertinent to... Something's unhappy here. And what this means from a statewide perspective. First, HMSC started with bare land on fill that was leased from the Port of Newport. And in the intervening 40-plus years, it has really grown dramatically, both with OSU facilities, our ship support facility, as well as a variety of federal and state agencies. And as of last year, our annual budget combined was on the order of $40 million annually, with split evenly, with about half of it at Oregon State University, with 120 staff and 180 staff in the different federal and state agencies there. Of this $40 million, only about $10.5 million are state dollars. The remainder are federal dollars. And I particularly point out at Oregon State University, only about $4.8 million of that 20 per year are state dollars, the remainder being federal monies that are brought in. I won't go through this in any detail other than to say that Hatfield is a real crossroads for marine science at Oregon State University. We have five different colleges represented there, either in educational outreach or research endeavors, and several institutes and centers within our center, including a visitor center that sees about 150,000 members of the public per year. We have seven different federal and state agency elements there. I won't go into detail on these. The only state one is the Oregon Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, which is very active there and growing. But I also want to point out that NOAA is already in Newport and has had buildings there since 1978. We have three different elements, research elements of NOAA, two from different components of the National Marine Fisheries Service, and one, the VENTS program, which you probably hear a little bit about because they do geological work and get a lot of publicity with respect to earthquake and undersea volcanism work that they do. The new developments, and Don showed this, HMSC, the Oregon Coast Aquarium is next door. We work closely with them on educational endeavors. The international terminal, where the NOAA fleet will be located. And there's additional land where we could see a future of an industrial research park, potentially, if the landowners go and the community support that direction. Again, Don has very well covered this topic, but what is this facility? It is not a research facility. It is an infrastructure facility supporting research. We won't ever see a picture like this. The purpose of these vessels is to be at sea, and that's what they do for a living. So they're out at sea up to 240 days per year. So we'll probably see one or two here at a time, the rest being out to sea. And the facility is really meant to support their operations. It will have effects, though, on Hatfield and marine science in general. There will be a greater ease of use for the NOAA programs for vessel use. There will be greater opportunities for collaboration for Oregon State University. And importantly, it complements the academic research fleet with the WACOMA. And I do want to thank you for the support and the resolution that was led by Representative Cowan for support of the replacement of the WACOMA. We will see a lot more scientists visiting Newport, and we'll get greater exposure as a national resource. I'd like to talk a bit about the different initiatives, and I don't want to presage the later discussion on wave energy, but simply to point out that the investments that the state has made in wave energy through the governor's initiatives, the innovation agenda, and the support of the legislature have led to dramatic leveraging of research funds. Here in this case, the designation of the National Marine Renewable Energy Center at Oregon State University would have been impossible because of the matching funds required from the state. This is leading to significant additional funding, and wave energy, Oregon, because of this, will become a center of wave energy that I think will have economic implications in the future. The Marine Mammal Institute is growing in leaps and bounds. They've recruited two new faculty with all their proposals, all of their students and technicians. But they are limited in this very aggressive growth program that they have by space in our facility. Bruce Mate has done a great job of making the research international in scope. The addition of the two new faculty have really been beneficial. And it is now the largest academic marine mammal program in the United States. And if it grows the way we hope, it will probably take over internationally for that designation. I'll also note that they are presently located entirely in the NOAA buildings at Oregon State University as opposed to being in Oregon State buildings. The third I'll mention is the Ocean Observing System. The federal government, through the National Science Foundation, has allocated a global initiative of some $364 million. Our College of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences is a partner at OSU with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in leading the coastal elements, and OSU will be getting over the next 5 years some $14 million, and this will involve vessels, buoys, and autonomous vehicles. And to the north, the University of Washington has a cabled observatory, which will literally cost probably $100 million to install. And that doesn't include the science that will be done. So the Pacific Northwest is a real focus for this kind of activity, and there will be a lot of funding going into it. We obviously will need infrastructure for these facilities, and you may have heard about what's been termed the Marine Mammal and Marine Genomics Building. Because OSU staff occupy roughly 50% of the NOAA facilities, the three buildings on our campus, we are concerned that as the NOAA infrastructure grows, that the NOAA science staff will grow, potentially moving our staff out of the NOAA buildings. If that leads to displacements, we could be in real trouble. And as I note on the top of this slide, the last OSU research facility were in the original buildings built in 1965. There's been nothing since. We have a proposal in to get $14 million from the federal government, and we will require $9 million of state. All of the staff would move from the NOAA facilities, which would permit OSU growth significantly in both marine mammal and marine genomics areas. Other infrastructure needs, I mentioned appreciating your support for the WACOMA. That proposal will be submitted to the U.S. Navy tomorrow. And this is a roughly $60 million vessel. Its operational budget, if it were to come here, will be on the order of $6 million per year. And there is a very distinct difference between academic research fleets and the NOAA research fleets, which are really mission-oriented. So having this will really complement it and cement Oregon as a leader in ocean research. And then for ocean observing, facilities are being planned right now in Corvallis for the program, and we are examining cooperatively facilities with the new NOAA facility for support of the ocean observing program. Overall, I'll just close with Oregon's Coastal and Ocean Enterprises really being something that rivals the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and Woods Hole. It's not generally recognized, but if you number the number of people involved, if you count the budgets involved, we're probably number three in the United States after those two institutions. And there are a lot of competitors who would like to be as broad as we are. But it requires that we not just look at Newport. Newport itself is not competitive with these other entities. You have to include all of the ocean enterprise, especially Oregon State University with our various colleges that are very active in ocean sciences. And if you go up and down the coast, this is a coast-wide enterprise. We have the Astoria Seafood Laboratory. We have marine elements at both Portland State and OHSU. The Oregon Institute of Marine Biology in Charleston, which is a very nice marine laboratory. State agencies engaged in this activity. A big focus, as I mentioned, of federal agencies, which has the potential to grow. South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve and potential developments in Port Orford. So marine science growth has potential implications coastwide. And finally, we look at this as something that will lead to phased economic development with the state stimulus that has gone on already leveraging significantly federal funds and bringing in the kinds of things that are going to leverage additional federal funds. But the real benefit is going to be the long-term benefit of the research that gets done, because this is going to lead to business growth, and ultimately it's going to result in related industries coming to Oregon, and that's where we see the real potential economic growth. And I'll just mention, the Aquinabay Economic Foundation put out a report, and it was the program was actually led by Don Mann and myself, to develop a strategic framework for Aquinabay becoming a focal point for this nationally, for this in the Pacific Northwest in particular. And I'll make copies of this report available through Representative Cowan, if any of you are interested. But this new NOAA facility is really, it could be considered almost a child of this, because this process of developing this report led to a very dramatic amount of community support. And we see that this has implications that can really lead to coast-wide expansion. And with that, I thank you for your attention and would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bollert, for making the trip over today along with Mr. Mann and Ms. Goldblush. I appreciate getting the update. It's exciting to hear about all this good work and important work being done on the coast. And I think to a large extent, to some extent, the NOAA news reflects, you know, your success, Representative Cowan, last session and the work of this legislature. It's important to be reminded of what we did and the effects that it's had. Let's see if there are questions before we move on. Representative Boone.
It's not a question so much as a thank you so much for all you do, and this has just put Oregon on the map. I do several international conferences in ocean energy, and everywhere I go, people stop me and say, tell us about Oregon, tell us what's happening. You're so lucky that, you know, the coast now is getting this new NOAA thing, because they see that as an opportunity, too. So, and thanks to Rep. Cowan for just keeping on it. And the port, everybody. Thank you, everybody.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to share some of our thoughts with you this morning. It really was a very much a community effort, and the timing that the port described was very challenging in the last session, and they needed an answer in June before we could really complete our deliberations. So the legislative body's support of the potential that was there, knowing that we might or might not be successful, was a huge factor in the whole consideration, and for that we're grateful. I do believe that it was confidence well earned and well spent, because this is going to develop a great deal for the state of Oregon. You may hear just a little bit more from me as we talked about the Marine Mammal Institute. We have the grant request in that they'll hear in February, so this might come up in the February session, but we'll need a little match and some fund shifting to make that happen. It will pull the whole package together, and I appreciate your interest in the coast. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. Thanks very much. Move to our next item, Ed Bowles, if you want to come on up. See if the computer's still working.
Thank you, Co-Chair Cannon. I will just take a moment and see if we're online. Mr. Cannon, members of the committees, my name is Ed Bowles, the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. It looks like we're good to go, so I'll jump right in. I was asked to give a kind of informational update on the Marine Reserve process. A lot has been happening since the legislature embraced House Bill 3013 and sent it off to us to begin its implementation. So I'm just going to walk you through some of that. Just in background, Executive Order 0807 from the governor gave us some very clear sideboards on making sure that it was 9 or fewer sites that we considered in moving forward on this. The key in the balancing act that made it so intriguing was the need to be ecologically meaningful for these marine reserve sites, but to balance that with avoiding socioeconomic hardship. And then to reward the collaboration, particularly with an emphasis on the coastal communities working together to come up with this appropriate balance and these sightings for proposals. The policy body making recommendations for this tough work was OPAC, the Ocean Policy Advisory Council, and they were able to, through their several-year process, come up with moving forward 6 areas. 2 is pilot sites for immediate designation, and then 3 for further evaluation, and 1 to develop a new proposal. And I'll just walk you through, if I can, the locations, just to remind you. On the right is actually North Coast and Cape Falcon, the Cascade Head, and then down further, Cape Perpetua, Mid-Coast, are all 3 sites that are for further evaluation by community teams that I'll be talking about in a minute. The 2 pilot areas are the one at Otter Rock, just south of Depot Bay, and Redfish Rocks, just south of Fort Orford. those are ready to go, and I'll talk a little bit about rule designation, designation of rules for those. The last one is the Cape Arago area. The Ocean Policy Advisory Council did not adopt a proposal as a starting point for that one, but the International Port of Coos Bay stepped up and agreed to put a group together to consider a proposal for a site in that area. So those are the six areas that are currently in play for consideration of marine reserves. This all is the outgrowth of roughly 20 proposals submitted to OPAC covering nine basic areas of the Oregon coast. So from that OPAC recommendation, it came and landed in the legislative lap. House Bill 3013 was a consequence of that. It was to implement the OPAC recommendations. The funding for this that came out of last session was $1 million from the new CARISA settlement, unobligated funds. ODFW was designated the lead agency, working with sister agencies and these community groups to move this forward in implementation. It's implemented via a work plan, which details out the day-to-day activities and what we're trying to accomplish. And the further work, not only for the sites that we're going to be evaluating further, but also the pilot areas, is done through community teams that are designated to help sort through the scientific issues as well as the socioeconomic issues. I'd like to talk a little bit more about those community teams. This is very essential for these three areas that I referred you to, the Falcon, Cascade, and Perpetua areas. Those are those sites for further evaluation. We're designating one team per site. Sideboards for this are that it's balanced and diverse representation of the various interest groups, open to the public. If we get the financing, we will also have facilitation for each of these groups, and they will be funneling recommendations to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The two pilot sites, which aren't really debating the location of the sites, they'll really be working on moving forward the implementation of those two areas. And then the Coos Bay sites are not required by 3013 to align with that statute's provisions on community teams, but they're being encouraged to, and most of them are doing that. Now, I mentioned about the rulemaking. We have a designation in 3013 for us to establish administrative rules for the two pilot areas. And it's a joint process, not only with my agency, but also Department of State Lands and the Parks and Recreation Department. And it's been a kind of a joint process all throughout, many venues for public input, but we had three official public meetings in October. And our rulemaking will be for the Land Board and the Fish and Wildlife Commission will be early December, and then Parks and Recreation Commission will be in January. Next steps, of course, designating and implementing the two pilot sites. I talked about the rulemaking. We'll also be developing the monitoring plans, conducting baseline data and the monitoring surveys, and developing the management plans for that with those community teams. And then to me, the real effort that to keep your to pay attention to are these further collaboration and development evaluation of these four other areas. We're establishing the community teams, as I mentioned, that is happening right now. The nominations for those community teams are due at the close of business this Friday. We are working closely with the sponsors of House Bill 3013 to ensure, this is the Coastal Caucus sponsors, on which I'd like to recognize Representative Boone as one of those members, and are helping us shepherd through this to make sure we stay clean to the intent of that legislation. We'll be doing biological and socioeconomic assessments to bring additional information to those groups, and then working with them to refine and recommend sites from those original OPAC proposals that came in. That's for the Cape Falcon, Cascade Head, and Cape Perpetua areas. And then, of course, working with the Coos Bay folks to develop a new proposal potentially for the Cape Arago area. Then potential designation and implementation for these additional four areas would potentially occur after consideration through the budget process and the governor's budget, as well as your legislative process with the 11th session. That's all I had for the brief summary, Co-Chair Cannon. I do have, there's a lot of information on this that I'd encourage you to pay attention to the website. We're trying to be very careful in making sure that that has all updated information. We also have I think it's about a 400-plus name listserv that gets everything that goes on this. So we're trying to be very transparent in how we move forward. Thank you.
Appreciate the presentation, Ed. Is there any questions?
I have a question on the Senate side. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick budget question. The $1 million came out of the new Carissa Fund, and you made mention of the community team, so on and so forth. Where are we on the $1 million budget, and is what you've presented fully funded through this biennium?
Co-Chair Cannon and Senator Boquist, the $1 million has been implemented. Some of it is in hiring five positions within the agency. And we're still just closing out, making those offers. The interviews are all complete. Different positions have been hired. There is a lead for this Marine Reserve program. There are two scientists, a community liaison, and then a socioeconomic analyst that'll be helping out. So that's where part of that budget went. We have a large portion of that budget, actually about 40% of it, that is going towards collaborative research work with the fleets as well as other groups in order to get the socioeconomic and the biological information. Bear in mind that what we're trying to do is inform these community teams, of which we do have limited funds, Senator, to help support some of their operations because it is a burden to take on the records and meeting logistics. So we are supplying some monies for that. But we're trying to inform these community teams the best possible socioeconomic and biological information to help them make their decisions. And so this isn't going to be a lot of additional heavy-duty research. This is what we call rapid area assessments with the biological side of making sure we know what is the habitat, what are the species available, and then surveys and experiential knowledge on the social and economic side of things. I would mention, and many of you are involved in this as well, additional parts of the new Carissa settlement unobligated funds went to seafloor mapping, and that was coupled with federal dollars to do a lot of that. That information is vital not only to this Marine Reserve process, but also to many other issues, part of which you'll talk later this morning on, and that information is coming in as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ed. Oh, before you get down.
Yes, just quickly following up on Senator Booker's question, part of this $1 million has gone for salaries or for personnel. Four, did you say? Or five?
Representative, there's five positions.
Five positions.
There were, okay. In our original budget, there was eight, but because only half of the budget was provided.
The question is, are those limited duration positions?
Co-Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Benson. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, the question, I guess, is, are Washington or California doing similar things, or are we at when it comes to these marine reserves?
Co-Chair Cannon and Representative Bentz, there's a lot of international as well as national work on marine reserves. Washington has some efforts afoot, primarily in Puget Sound. California is very heavily into a process to designate marine reserves and marine protected areas. They have done a lot, fits and starts, if you will, on moving through that process. Much of our coastal communities are very cautious of marine reserves because of the process that California went through. We are trying to do things a little differently, and that's part of why 3013 paid so much attention on a very community-based coastal flavor to this with real transparency built in and clear objectives and not overreaching, if you will. And so I guess I make that comment in the context of what California is doing. Depending on your perspective, it can be good and bad, but we're trying to learn from it either way.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. I know many of us are hearing about this process as it moves forward, and it's important to get these updates. So thanks for keeping us informed, and I know the House Committee will be continuing to check in with you probably next in February and then again beyond. So
thank
look forward
you
to hearing how this develops.
Okay, so we're ready to move into the second part of our agenda here, or I should say this morning. And just a reminder for the Senate members, we are leaving at a few minutes before 10 to go join the House Agricultural Committee because we are hearing about wolves and cougars the rest of the morning. I know everyone's very excited about that. But we have about 50 minutes or just under. Unfortunately, you guys lost some time this morning because we were running a little late. But I'd like to call up the panel for product stewardship. We have Palmer Mason from the Department of Environmental Quality, Abby Sporteris, hopefully I got that right, and Kathy Koala. And colleagues both in the House and Senate, you probably recall that we've had a number of issues regarding product stewardship over the past years. The e-waste bill that passed in 2007, and then last session we passed a paint stewardship bill. So I think we're going to hear updates on both of those and then also efforts to move forward. We did have a comprehensive product stewardship bill last session that did not pass, but we have asked the department to continue working on that effort. So I think we're going to hear updates on that. Palmer, take it away.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Chair Cannon, and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me Abby Borderas and Kathy Koala, also of the Department of Environmental Quality. Thank you for having us here today. We've been asked to talk about product stewardship. We're excited to talk about product stewardship because DEQ thinks that product stewardship takes us beyond what we have in curbside recycling. We have successful curbside recycling programs here in Oregon, but product stewardship helps us deal with products that aren't as well recovered under those particular programs. As you can probably appreciate, recycling a TV is not the same thing as recycling a glass bottle. So these particular programs help us recover those products from the waste stream where we can recycle them and also manage the toxics that might come from them. Abby's going to talk about the new paint legislation that's being implemented, and Kathy will talk about the successes that we've had with the e-waste program. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the process going forward on product stewardship and what that might entail and what we might be talking about possibly in 2011. So, again, thank you for the time. And is it set up? Okay.
Yeah, it's not on the screen, though.
Okay.
We've been having a little bit of technical difficulties, but why don't you get started because we have the handouts and we are short on time.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Dingfelder and Cannon, for inviting us here today and committee members. My name is Abby Borderas. I'm the Household Hazardous Waste Coordinator for DEQ, and I will talk about the first in the nation's paint product stewardship law.
It's on the screen now.
Okay, great. So I'm just going to take one quick step backwards on why we care about paint.
Before you go on, can you also... I think there's been a lot of confusion, so I think it would be really important to define what product stewardship is, just so everybody's sort of on the same page.
I think that's... Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. The department defines product stewardship as a waste management approach where we involve the manufacturers, the distributors, and the users of a particular product in the end-of-life management. And so what we're asking is the people who make, import the product and who use the product are involved in making sure that product is properly disposed of or collected and recycled. And that's the way we typically tend to view these programs. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, in that context, we'll take a step back and talk about what household hazardous waste is, and there's a photo there. It's all the unwanted chemicals in your homes, basements, garages. About 20 years ago in Oregon, we started collecting these materials through collection events and permanent facilities. Largely, it was one day. Now throughout the state, we have more and more ongoing and regular collection services. Next slide. But in that household hazardous waste, lots and lots and lots of it is paint. About 50% of everything that comes in is paint. That's both latex and oil-based paint. In fact, 10% of all paint sold is leftover. So because of that and the programs around the nation and the world, paint product stewardship began. It's been a long journey to get from the beginning of that to where we are today. In 1994, British Columbia passed the first comprehensive stewardship program and began a program collecting paint. In 1997, inspired by that, we had our Paint Smart program here run by DEQ, which was a return to retail collection effort. In 2003, and that was a one-year pilot that actually continued on in a number of stores with local government support, actually to this day. In 2003, a national group formed the Paint Product Stewardship Initiative, and that was a stakeholder process of industry and government and other interested people to look for a long-term solution to this paint problem. In 2005 and 2007, some national agreements were signed. The first was some research, and the second was a strategy to come up with a national solution, first with a demonstration state and then a rollout to other states. Oregon was actually expected to be among the second set of states. The first was to be Minnesota. Legislation was introduced and passed in 2008 and vetoed by their governor. In 2009, they reintroduced in Minnesota and fortunately introduced in Oregon as well. We were meant to be a backup or the next rollout state. It was vetoed again in Minnesota and very fortunately passed here. I bring on this slide, I do this a lot, this presentation. It was signed by the governor because that was a very big deal to the paint industry that not only did it pass, but it was signed and ready to move forward. So to everyone, that doesn't seem as big a deal. The legislation really had four major points in it to establish a stewardship program, to undertake strategies to reduce the generation of leftover paint, to promote reuse, and to collect, transport, and process that leftover architectural paint and fund the end-of-life management. Just a couple definitions so that you understand the program a little more. That paint, architectural paint, that's generally wall paint. It's not specialty or industrial paint. It's not what manufacturers put on products. It covers both oil and latex paint in containers of 5 gallons or less. The program covers households and small businesses. There's a few key dates to key off of. The first was that by March 1st, a statewide pilot program, a plan for that program, needed to be submitted to provide convenient and available collection in both urban and rural areas of the state, and that it included an assessment to pay for that program. And then no later than July 1st, the stewardship organization must start reducing the generation of leftover paint and provide this collection system. And then the last key date was by October 2011. We'll report back to the legislature about the program and how to look at it forward since this is a pilot program.
And Abby, just to be clear, assessment is on the manufacturer?
Yeah, it's on the manufacturer chain. Between the retailer and the distributor.
Okay, and if the manufacturer's out of state, the assessment still occurs. It's not only for in-state.
Yes, any paint sold in Oregon must be covered, or else they cannot sell paint in Oregon. A little bit more about the next slide, the assessment. It's per container, so every container, it'll cover every container sold. The fee must be approved by DEQ, and that's to provide the necessary antitrust protection, so it's very important to the National Paint and Coatings Association. That the assessment must cover the cost of the program but not exceed it, so it's not a revenue generator for them. And that the assessment must be added to the cost of the paint. So that's so there's a level playing field. That every industry, every manufacturer would pay it, and all the prices would go up the same. And that there can be no fee charged at time of return. We don't yet know because we haven't been given the assessment, the plan from industry. In British Columbia, the fee is around 50 cents a container. We expect it to be in that range. So how will it work? Very quickly, stewardship organization has actually been formed. It's called Paint Care. It's a new nonprofit organization. We expect to see the plan ahead of schedule, probably in December. Because Minnesota didn't pass, they're hoping to get things done more quickly here in Oregon than they're required to. The plan must be approved, and we expect to do that early in the year. The assessment will start being charged. We expect everything to start April 1st, the assessment and all the collection opportunities. The education and waste prevention components will start. They've hired a local firm here in Oregon, Bradshaw, which will be doing both marketing and education. The collection will start. We expect it to be both in retail and local government infrastructure. It'll be transported and consolidated. The latex will largely be recycled. The oil-based used burned for energy recovery. Recycled paint will be promoted, and whatever cannot be recycled will be disposed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Przanski.
Just follow up, since you're on that slide regarding the collection part. What I heard you say is that basically we're going to continue to allow, let's say, local governments that are already doing this to continue to be part of this program.
Yes.
And then we'll incorporate where we don't have retail collection now. So the sites for consumers will be potentially at retail stores as well as, let's say, a transfer station that a county government may run.
Yes, we expect it to be the existing household hazardous waste programs and retail. And if that's not enough, then transfer stations as well.
Right. Thank you.
So the milestones, just very quickly, there's been a series of stakeholder meetings all sort of leading up to that April 1st start date when the whole program should roll out. We expect it to be not quite as robust as it will be on April 1st, but there should be full statewide service at that time. So just very quickly, what does it mean for Oregon? A couple key things. We should see better collection in places that there is collection now. We'll see collection where there have been no opportunities, and we'll see substantial cost savings for local governments who do now collect at least $1 million a year just in the metro area alone. That's a map of the existing infrastructure. The white is where there is no collection now, so they'll see the largest change. And then finally, I wanted to mention, what does it mean for the United States? We are the demonstration state for the nation. There is a large group of stakeholders that are involved and very interested in how this rolls out. There's an EPA-funded evaluation of the program, and then how it rolls out in Oregon will inform the other states.
Thank you. Okay, any questions on this particular portion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chair, a couple of questions, if I may, short questions. Since this is the best thing since sliced bread and apple pie and Chevrolets, why is it that the governor of Minnesota, not known to be the most conservative governor in the nation, vetoed this on two occasions?
I wish I could actually give you an answer. It's in some ways unknown to a lot of people. Everyone thought he would vote pass it the second time. He was concerned because they pay for household hazardous waste collection in Minnesota through taxes that people already paid for that, and they have quite an elaborate system there now. So he felt like it was double taxing. It was a very political move on his part.
follow-up?
Actually, a separate question, though it is a follow-up on that. I note that this program has been in existence now for some time in your early slide, even going back to 08 when first legislation passed in Minnesota. And discussion about, you know, some of the volunteer programs we had around the state of Oregon back in a decade, you know, before this. Again, since this is, you know, a great idea with all of the before mentioned Chevrolets thrown into it, why no other state in the United States other than Minnesota and Oregon have managed to be able to persuade a legislatures to pass legislation of this type?
Well, actually, they're queuing up. If you remember, the map has the other states that want to. This was a result of this five-year stakeholder process, and the agreement with industry was to start in one state, demonstrate it, and then based on that, roll it out to the other states. So actually, Connecticut and Vermont and California, we expect this next year. And then there are nine other states that are ready, and the industry has been very clear, the National Paint and Coatings Association, that they want to do it in a stepwise, orderly fashion to do it and to do it the same way everywhere.
Okay. Representative Jensen is also... because we're so innovative here, so we are leading the nation on these programs. But
also, preciously close, Madam Co-Chair, if I may, on leading the nation in unemployment.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a direct correlation between.
I'm not sure there is either. I'd like to lead the nation sometimes in other ways than what
should be
not necessarily regarding this.
Hopefully, we'll be stimulating some recycling jobs, which you're actually going to hear about, I think, in the next presentation as well. But I have a quick follow up on one of the points that you mentioned about offsetting the costs. Can you explain how household hazardous waste collections programs are currently funded in Oregon, and how this program might help offset those costs for local governments?
Absolutely. Right now, most household hazardous waste programs are funded by solid waste tip fees. Most of them cannot provide enough service, and then there are places where there are no service. The places that will save probably about 25% of their budget, because they will at the very least not need to pay for disposal and recycling of the paint they collect. So that's where the actual savings is. They will likely be collecting more and more hazardous materials with the money they save.
All right, thank you.
Madam Co-Chair,
Representative Jensen.
I feel a need to somehow or another defend my position here.
On jobs or Chevrolets?
Either.
Or both.
I
don't
all
think
of
there
the
are
above.
Any more Chevrolets. Are there?
Actually, you know, I think I have in my home a sufficient amount of paint, if we ever got the real estate industry going, that I could handle painting all of the houses that would be developed in a year in my city. So, and what I had done is decided that this was going to be one of the inheritances that my children would get, to deal with at that inappropriate time.
Well, your children may be happy about this program.
Yeah, they're happier than I am.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, Representative Vance?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. One of the hardware store dealers I spoke with about this informed me that this program wasn't necessary at all, because you simply needed to open the cans of paint and let them sit there and evaporate and then have them hauled to the landfill. What's the normal response to that suggested alternative?
It is recommended for paint cans that aren't all the way full, usually a quarter or less, for latex paint that you can dry it out. Paint cans that are more full can be recycled into usable paint. Actually, Miller Paint is now selling Metro's recycled product. Oil-based paint is not well disposed that way. It's better if it's collected and then burned for energy recovery in a safer method. Did that answer your question?
Follow-up? Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the question is, or his point was, we're doing all of this expensive circular program, and it's just so simple in his own mind to simply take the tops off, let it dry out, and haul it to our current landfills. And I was just curious if there was some environmental negative that was so great that I should be explaining it to him, and I wasn't sure what that was. Is this stuff that goes into the landfill that's oil-based then bad, or what is it exactly that prevents his idea from being the logical alternative to what we now have here in Oregon?
First of all, the volumes, it's often much too much, as Representative Jansen brought out. Basements are full, so it's a lot of material to dry out for the latex paint. The latex paint has a resource value, so you're saving all the upstream impacts of producing paint when you can recycle it in the first place, so it's not wasted. And then the volatile components of the oil-based paint should not be evaporated into the air.
Okay. Last follow-up.
I'll just say I didn't use those arguments. I simply told him that I thought it would be dangerous to have all those open cans around while he wandered stumbling around and I kicked them over. That was my argument.
Okay. And one other point I'll mention is that a lot of those cans are not often empty. And I know
yes.
we have a bad habit in our house of buying paints of cans of paint and trying it out and then going back and buying another can of paint, and then we're like, we have this almost full can, and what do we do? So we have been taking advantage of the Metro facility in the Metro area. But anyway, any other last burning questions before we move on to, I think, the e-waste update? Is that correct?
Yes, although if I may, Chair Dingfeld, I did want to recognize a couple of people on the paint bill. First, Representative Berger. She was very helpful in getting the legislation filed and working with us. And then also Representative Reed was very helpful in moving the bill through the process. And then lastly, the paint industry was a great partner in this, and we really couldn't have done it without them. And I think they do look to Oregon as a place to test out this concept and see that it works. And I think that it will, and then they can take it to the rest of the country. So I did want to recognize their involvement.
Great. Thank you. Okay, Kathy, if you could make sure and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and Chair Cannon. For the record, my name is Kathy Koala with Oregon DEQ, and I lead the project for the e-waste product stewardship law that was passed here in Oregon in 2007. I'm going to start off. I don't know how many of you are familiar. I'm going to give you a very quick rundown on what the bill was about, what the law set in motion, and then talk about what the program has rolled out to be. In addition to the presentation, you also have a fact sheet that we developed. So a lot of the good details are contained on that. Here's the basic outline of what the law put in place. It was a product stewardship law, so it looked at the manufacturers of televisions, computers, and monitors and put responsibility on those manufacturers if they were selling in or into Oregon to make sure to take care of their products at the end of their life. There was also a proportioning of responsibility back on those manufacturers. They have a registration fee. There's four tiers based on the size of the volume of their sales. And there's also their recycling responsibility is based on the size or the volume of their materials coming back through the system. What the law did do was provide flexibility for those manufacturers, and it allowed them to take a choice of what type of recycling program they could be a participant in. Manufacturers really wanted that opportunity to have some control over what their program might look like. It also included retailer involvement. Retailers in Oregon or selling into Oregon can only sell brands that are listed in compliance with the law, our law here, and also it requires them to provide some education at the point of sale to anybody going in to buy one of these products that are new. Consumer education, it occurs at the point of sale and also through the recycling programs and also from DEQ and local governments and others. The law said use existing infrastructure as much as possible, so it required a network of collection sites to be established throughout the state, but it said use what's out there, don't go out and create if you don't need to, but it needs to be convenient for the citizens in Oregon. And there was some performance accountability set into the law. Programs had a minimum responsibility that they needed to meet, and so that is one of the they have to submit plans, the DEQ approves them, and then there are certain activities they have to carry out, and we track those. this is what the program actually looks like to the consumer, to the public. Starting off at the point of sale, they go to buy something, and as I said, they hopefully will only be able to find those products that are compliant with the law. They'll get information about how to recycle, how to get in contact, find out about Oregon eCycles recycling or collection points. When they get their new product home, they've got to figure out what to do with that old product or the ones that are sitting in the garage or in the basement or the closet or the back of the room. You probably have one. Maybe it's a reusable. They think it's reusable. It still works. Or maybe it just really is dead and needs to go off to recycling. We do have some collection sites in the state that do pull off a couple of the items. They'll do some testing and send it into a reuse stream, and others they'll just send it off into recycling. So there's a lot of sites throughout the state. Anyone using the program can be confident that their old product is going off to be recycled through a set of recyclers that are following our environmental management practices that we established for the program. Here's some examples of some of the point of sale. We did bring some of these along. These are just some cards and brochures that the retailers have available. We have these Oregon DEQ, Washington Department of Ecology, and some retailers sat down in a focus group, worked out what types of materials might the retailers use, and came up with, were able to do some cost sharing with Washington and also come up with some good materials. There's also some, if you've been to Costco or some other places, they actually have a sticker that we made up, and they'll just put this nice bright green sticker on the outside of the box. And those are all these materials are on our website and downloadable by the retailers. So yeah. It makes it easy
Kathy,
for them.
Kathy, how are you dealing with internet sales?
We've only had a chance to do some minimal checking, but we do have some text that we provide to them that they can put on their website. And there was some complexities about how they would do that if they'll just put it on their opening splash page of their site, or if it would only pop up when the consumer wrote in a state of Oregon. So we need to do a little more follow-up on that. This is what the program looks like on the inside. We call the program Oregon eCycles. It's the nice catch name for people. Underneath it are actually four collection and recycling programs operating throughout the state, and three of those are manufacturer programs, and one is a state-run program. All of those recycling programs essentially have the same set of requirements. They have to have set up this collection network throughout the state. They have to have their collectors and recyclers follow these management practices. They have to do some outreach and education, meet goals, et cetera. And so they're very similar. There's two exceptions. The manufacturer programs, they have to meet, they have to submit a plan. We have to approve it. And not every manufacturer can go out and do a plan. They have to have meet a certain size requirement to be able to do that, or they can join together in groups. And then the other difference is that in the state contractor program, they would not have any penalties applied if they did not reach their return share, minimum return share requirement. So those four programs are operating throughout the state. They look quite differently, even though they all have the same set of requirements. You can see the MRM program has 21 manufacturers participating in that program. Most of those are television manufacturers. They have 160 collection sites throughout the state. They don't hold any special events because they have enough sites throughout that cover the whole state. And they work with one recycler, and that's a recycler in Clackamas, Oregon. It's a brand new facility, CRT processing. They came in, they're based out of Wisconsin. They set up a facility here, hired workers and staff, and so it's a brand new business here in Oregon. I will point out most of those manufacturers are TV manufacturers, and we do have one little glitch in the law that we do look forward to fixing at some point, in that the TV manufacturers are treated a little bit differently, whether they're, if they're in the state contractor program versus if they're in an independent manufacturer program. So likely you will hear something on that in the near future. Here's the other programs. Dell is one program. They're operating their program on behalf of themselves. They have a partnership with Goodwill. They have a national partnership. You'll see how many collection sites they have. They actually have a smaller requirement, but because of their partnership with Goodwill, they have so many sites across the state, in addition to a few events, and so they are just going great guns. The state contractor program is somewhat the default program. Any manufacturer that doesn't head off into one of these independent programs stays in the state contractor program. We have some large ones and some small ones, lots of small and medium ones, and they are able to meet the requirements of the law through participating in this program. Moving on to look at what are those programs performing like, you can see they each had different requirements. Their minimum obligation was set at the beginning of the year before the year even started, and between the first and the third quarter, so this is data only up through the end of the third quarter, you can see that the programs are just moving along great guns. Indeed, there are a lot of old products sitting around out there in garages and basements, but not so much anymore. We have them coming through the program. We had originally set a goal of 12.2 million pounds, and we are currently at 14.3 million pounds have come through the program, and we still have one quarter left in the year. We also, you'll notice, we have units going through to reuse, so those are coming through some of those reuse sites that I talked about earlier. This is interesting to look at. This proportion of the materials coming through the program has remained constant through each quarter. Televisions, no surprise, are the larger volume of weight coming through the program. We've seen projection TVs. We've seen big old council TVs. It's really kind of a walk through history when you go into some of these recycling and collection facilities to see the different types of models that are there. We've even seen some flat screen TVs starting to come through. We have, this is just a little bit of a capture. I've pretty much covered all this in the previous slides of here's what we've accomplished in this amount of time of implementation. I think the last two items, outreach, we do have a website that's used. We have a hotline people can call. We have a lot of downloadable materials that are up there for people, for local governments, haulers, retailers who want to start getting the word out to their constituents or consumers. And we have had a public process. We've had an advisory work group that's been working since the beginning with us to help us get the program kind of figured out and working well. And here's what's coming up in this next year. We have, this is actually our third cycle of registration of manufacturers coming through. We just opened that on October 15th, and that'll close, or it runs through the end of the year, although we do register them through the year as they come, if they're new or we find out about them. We expect to have, again, four programs operating. We've increased the goal for next year to 21.4 million pounds, and looks like we're on track to get 20 million pounds this year, I would think, somewhere very close to that. We'll be starting to do some sampling. The disposal ban, which was also part of the law, kicks in on January 1st. We've got materials. We've worked with some stakeholder groups to get solid waste facility permits modified and get the word out. And we'll be starting into some rulemaking. And we still have our advisory work group going. So hopefully, I'm just going to stop there. One other thing I would like to bring up. I mentioned there was a problem, a glitch in the law with how TV manufacturers are considered. I think one other thing that I wanted to bring up, we are a startup program, and there are actually 16 other states across the country that have e-waste laws and one city. We were actually the sixth in the country to get a law passed, and so we're one of the earlier implementers. There are other ones are still, there were a slew of laws that were just passed this year, and so they're not even quite to the implementation stage. So we're doing startup from like the dirt from the ground up. So we've had some startup costs. We've attempted to cover those with the registration fees. We're not quite there. We've had to get some subsidy from solid waste, tip fees to manage to cover some of that, but we're working through the issues.
Thank you. Got a few minutes for questions, and then we need you to wrap up so we can get Andy up here. And I actually would start out with two quick questions. One of these I'm channeling Representative Jensen because I'm assuming he's going to be asking this. But even though it wasn't required in the law, have you tracked how many new jobs have been created through this process? You talked about a new facility in Clackamas. I don't know if you've been tracking that, but that would be, I think, good information to have.
We will be looking at that. We have done some tracking. We had some inquiries early on, and we checked in with some of the recycling facilities, and we know that they've had to ramp up. The ones that are in the program have had to ramp up and increase some jobs for that. And then at the collection sites, they've had, I don't know that there's been an increase in staff, but I know particularly for Goodwill, who has had a large volume come through their facilities, they have been able to supply some good jobs, training opportunities for their people coming through.
And then the other thing that was issue was discussed during the drafting of the legislation was ensuring that we weren't offshoring and, you know, sending computers and monitors overseas. There was a lot of concern at the time. There was a lot of exposure about recycling practices in other countries that had environmental concerns. So can you mentioned about the environmental compliance. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, Chair Dingfelder. That is a big concern. We still get calls from citizens about that. And so what we're able to say is that while all of the recycling facilities are not in the state of Oregon, where it would be much easier to control, there's one actually recycling facility in Vancouver, Washington, and one down in California. We don't have the authority as a state to control export, but what we do have the ability to do is say when these recycling plants come through is we've said these are the environmental management practices you need to use, or you can use something better. And some of the plans are using some even stricter standards. Dell, for example, has their own set of standards they apply. If a television or a computer or monitor comes through the door of the Oregon eCycle site, the practices attach themselves to those materials. And so we require, as a requirement of the plan and of our contractor, that all of those materials need to be managed, no matter if it stays here in the state or if it goes down to California or wherever. So those products are all, to my knowledge, at least getting processed down to a commodity level within the states.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful in the next round of data gathering when you look at jobs created also what percentage of materials are actually being recovered here in state versus exported to other states or, you know, I don't know if they're still exporting as far as overseas, but I think that would be helpful, and certainly you can request that information of the manufacturers and the folks who are running the program. So I think that would be something really important to track.
Great. Move
forward.
Do that.
Thank you. Questions? It looks like Representative Jensen's about to ask one, but I'm looking at the clock.
You better rule
and move on.
Okay, we'll do that. Okay. So, Palmer, if you could wrap up for us, really appreciate it.
So, thank you, Chair Dingfelder. One of the things that was approved in the 2009-2011 legislatively adopted budget was authority for the department to hire two FTEs to expand all the work that we're doing on product stewardship. And I think you can see from these presentations there's quite a bit that's happening in the world of product stewardship. And then a second piece of that was to put together a stakeholder process where we could get all the different points of view at the table, talk through product stewardship, how it works well in Oregon, what we can do better, what we might do differently, and then come back in 2011 with some legislative recommendations to the legislature. That stakeholder process will be kicking off in January of next year. We're going to have a stakeholder group that has roughly 20-plus different people on it, representing several manufacturers, the solid waste industry, local governments, the environmental community, some national organizations. We even want participation from other states to try and achieve some regional consistency on what we might do in product stewardship, those states being Washington and California. And again, we'll have a stakeholder process where that group will go through about 8 to 10 meetings and ultimately develop a report that will come back to the legislature.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you. Thank you all. Appreciate the updates. We'll look forward to hearing more about it. Next up, we have Andy Ginsberg. As you can see, we're transitioning right into air quality issues. And Andy, we're going to have to leave at 10, so I don't know if you can whip through your presentation, and then we might have to leave before there's or we can take questions from the Senate side, and then we have cougars and wolves waiting for us down the hall.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Ginsberg with the air quality program at DEQ, and unlike my previous presentations, I will be very brief. This is a brief summary of our status of implementation of some of the key air quality legislation that you passed last session. Here's the list, and I'm not going to go through all of them in detail. I'm going to mention a few highlights and focus on House Bill 2186. And so here's where we are. This is our implementation schedule for this legislation, and I hope you can read the table here. I'm going to skip over the low carbon fuel standard for now because I'm going to focus most of my presentation on that and let you know with the truck efficiency and idling, that was a key element of House Bill 2186. At the end of the session, that was converted from a requirement into a study, and so we will be evaluating those elements and then bringing back a recommendation to the interim committees next October. That work has not yet kicked off, although we're beginning conversations with stakeholders to try and identify the issues, and we're expecting to put our work group together in February, and then, as I said, we have a report due in October. With greenhouse gas reporting, we have kicked off our advisory committee. It's had three meetings so far, and the key issues from Senate Bill 38 were expanding greenhouse gas reporting to include electricity imports and fuel distribution. So we reassembled our original advisory committee, but we added additional members to cover those sectors, and in their initial meetings were focused on establishing a fee that was necessary to fund the program. We have a recommendation now from the committee on how to structure that fee, and that will be going to the Environmental Quality Commission next month. And now the committee has turned its focus on the reporting details for electricity imports and fuel distribution. The bill does include quite a few details about how that's to be done. For example, with electricity imports, it lays out in quite a bit of detail how those calculations will be done. For propane, it lays out, you know, a pathway there. And also the bill includes some performance standards requiring us to make use of existing information, coordinate with other agencies, and so forth. So we've been working with ODOT in particular because they collect a lot of information with regard to tax records that we'll be able to use in meeting the greenhouse gas reporting. So that process is moving along. We're aiming towards probably a rulemaking next August to implement the full Senate Bill 38. With Senate Bill 103, the key reason or the original goal for Senate Bill 103 was to provide an alternative to permitting for small businesses that were newly subject to federal regulations, and we've already begun implementing that for the auto body shops that are subject to a new federal requirement. Many of those shops participate in a voluntary certification program called EcoBiz, and for them, they won't have to get a permit. They'll have a lower cost alternative, and that is being included in the rule that's going to the Environmental Quality Commission next month, and also a similar provision for dry cleaners. With HeatSmart, that was our Senate Bill 102 with the focus on replacing uncertified wood stoves, removing uncertified wood stoves upon the sale of homes, and we're working with the dealers and the realtors on the details of implementation there, and that effort is going to be formally kicked off early next year, and we're aiming towards a rulemaking at the end of next year. And then finally, with field burning, Senate Bill 528, which phased out field burning in the Willamette Valley with the exception of burning on steep terrain. And we've been working with the Department of Agriculture and stakeholders on that bill. Department of Agriculture does the primary implementation, but DEQ has a role. And so we're doing joint rulemaking, and we'll have identical rules with them, and we've got our stakeholders group identified, and they'll be meeting next month. So all of this is moving along. I just want to focus on the low-carbon fuel standard. I don't expect you to be able to read this chart, but my point in putting this up is that these are the members of the low-carbon fuel standard advisory committee, and the point I want to make is how large this committee is. It's probably the largest committee we've ever worked with, and our goal was to include all of the stakeholders that have an interest or are affected by this program, and we do have representatives from everyone who supported and opposed the bill, as well as those who will be involved in implementing the bill and others. And so we have begun meetings. We've had one meeting. There's another meeting scheduled for early next month. And this is the list of issues they're going to be looking at. And I'm also not going to go through these in any detail right now. But just to let you know, there are 17 issues we identified, most of them coming out. The yellow portion show you which section of the bill those issues come from, and then other additional issues that we've identified. The committee's already identified an 18th issue. We are in the process of hiring a contractor to do the economic analysis for us. We were fortunate to receive a grant from EPA that will pay for that. So we're coordinating with the state of Washington, which is doing a very similar study at the same time. So this effort is going to be our most extensive and complex rulemaking. Our goal right now is to finish the rulemaking by the end of 2010. But what's more important than getting it done at any particular time is getting it done in the right manner and getting to the right outcome. So we are keeping the option open of extending the schedule for as long as it takes to do the rulemaking correctly. The bill delays implementation until July 2011 anyway. So if the rulemaking is not finished by December 2010, it won't necessarily delay implementation. So our focus really is on an open and inclusive advisory committee process. And I'll just show you here, we've established a new section of DEQ's webpage on advisory committees, and this it's a sort of a one-stop shop that you can get to from our homepage, which will take you to all advisory committees that DEQ currently runs, whether they're in air quality or other programs, and includes a new process for applying for and participating in our advisory committee. So our focus is on open and inclusive participation. And with that, I'll stop and see if you have any questions.
Thank you, Andy. Obviously, we're keeping you and your staff very busy the next few years. With that, we are going to recess. I want to thank Representative Cannon and for members for including us in your committee hearing today. I'm going to recess the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. We're going to reconvene in hearing room F. So we're just moving down the hall. Thank you again.
Thank you, and thank you, House Committee members. We will also recess for a 15-minute break, so please be back here promptly at 10:15 for continuation of our discussion of ocean issues with Representative Boone and Wave Energy. So we're also in recess.
Thanks, Beth.
Environment and Water. Nice to have a break in these four-hour meetings. Thank you, Beth, for helping schedule that into the agenda. We appreciate it. And let's go ahead now and hear from Representative Boone, and the topic is wave energy.
Thank you, Chair Cannon. I'm looking around and say, where is everybody? But they're all there. We changed a little bit. For the record, Deborah Boone, I represent House District 32, the beautiful upper left coast. And what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce this panel. We're talking about wave energy and ocean energy. And I'm going to have Kevin Bannister go first, and then Commissioner Mark Labhart from Tillamook County go second, and I'm going to pull clean up at the end.
Great.
So go ahead, Kevin.
No, thank you. Thanks, Representative Boone. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Bannister, Board President of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. And as my esteemed neighbor to the right here mentioned, we'll talk about wave energy, and I think the idea is that I give the sort of overview to what's happening in the state and with a touch on what's happening internationally and describe some of the efforts that have taken place in the state to help bring the industry here. So it probably starts, it's probably worth starting by describing the resource just a little bit and why the state has taken an interest in it. Wave energy, we're talking about the heaving, generally talking about the heaving motion in the waves. It's distinct from tidal energy, which converts the ebb and flow of the tide. So that's tidal energy is moving water. Wave energy is heaving, the heaving ocean wave. Waves. Sometimes technologies take advantage of the cresting action in waves, and there are several different, actually dozens of different technological concepts that are out there today. The ones that have seemed to gain traction here in Oregon are offshore devices and onshore devices. Offshore concepts like point absorbers that, again, take advantage of the heaving motion, and then onshore that may take advantage of the cresting action or pneumatic forces as waves enter and exit from a confined chamber, thereby pushing air through a turbine. So all of the technologies are pretty benign environmentally. Certainly no emissions associated with them, and of course, no fuel. So Oregon has some compelling advantages that has made it as a location jump off the map. We have a great wave resource here. There's transmission capacity, some transmission capacity coastally. There's port infrastructure, and there's supportive policies. We had a discussion yesterday about the RPS, and of course, the Betsy is something that has interested the development community as well. The resource itself has some advantages relative to other renewable resources. It's more predictable, has the potential to be forecasted as much as a day or perhaps even more in advance of the actual performance of the generating device, which is something that utilities find very, very attractive, and especially when compared to some of the other resources that we're increasingly relying on, like wind and solar, which are arguably more intermittent. So I want to talk about the Oregon Wave Energy Trust quickly, and then move through the rest of the talk. As you know, the Oregon Wave Energy Trust is funded by the legislature through the Oregon Innovation Council. It's a public-private partnership that has as a goal to help the industry develop responsibly in the state, with the intention of the economic benefits accruing from this emerging industry accruing in the state. Many people liken the status of the wave energy industry to that of the wind energy industry something like 20 or 25 years ago. Today, we know that the wind energy industry is a multi-billion-dollar global industry that has grown incredibly rapidly. If you look at the graph of its growth, it's the sort of classic hockey stick graph where it was slow growth, slow growth, slow growth, and then suddenly an explosion of growth. Do we think it's reasonable to anticipate that the same sort of growth will occur in the wave energy industry, and we're lucky enough to be paying attention to it now when we can take advantage of its newness, if you will. So OET was first funded back in 07, and over the last couple of years, we've sponsored programs that have been designed to attract the industry and promote the industry in the state. Many of them have been focused on establishing the environmental baseline conditions. We take very seriously the idea of responsible development. So the other programs that we've sponsored have included community outreach and an infrastructure assessment, and everything is really lining up to suggest that this is a good place for this type of development to happen. Our engagement at OET's been matched by engagement at the state and state agency level. The Territorial Sea Plan, which has just been adopted, includes basically the plan for the development of renewable energy resources in Oregon's waters, includes some very important concepts like adaptive management and phased development, so that as projects do proceed from smaller to presumably larger and ultimately full commercial facilities, there are some off-ramps if they're required, and very robust monitoring systems that get in place, but also the kind of certainty that developers need to make the large investments that will be required to develop these types of facilities. All of this work has attracted the notice of the international wave energy community, and over the last couple of years ago, we saw several technology developers come in. Some of them have stayed, some of them have left. The ones that have stayed include Ocean Power Technologies and a company called WaveGen. OPT has two projects that they're developing, one off of Reedsport and one off of Coos Bay. I've been authorized to say that shortly we should expect to see a purchase order for the construction of the first buoy off of Reedsport, which is a very big deal. It would mean that Oregon would be the first place in North America, the first place, in fact, outside of Europe, to have a full-scale device deployed, which is just a really remarkable achievement. The WaveGen is developing with Douglas County a project on the jetty at Reedsport, Winchester Bay, and this is one of the projects that, again, it's actually onshore, not offshore, so it's a very different type of development that doesn't require the same sort of mooring and installation and deployment challenges that something further offshore would. We're also seeing, these two companies that have remained engaged in developing projects in Oregon are very serious companies and very credible companies, backed with real balance sheet that we hope will enable them to develop the projects. At the same time, there seems to be, if you'll forgive the pun, something like a second wave of interest in the Oregon coast. I was in Europe earlier this month and had the opportunity to meet with several of the companies that are developing technologies, companies like Aquamarine, Wave Roller, a UK company and a Finnish company, respectively. Each of them have announced their real intent to come and take a good, long, hard look at developing projects and establishing a beachhead here in Oregon, which is really exciting news. With all that said, it is worth noting that the wave energy industry, it is still in its early days. I mentioned that it's been likened to the wind industry 20 or 25 years ago. So the first projects that are developed undoubtedly will be expensive projects. And so it is important to the industry that supportive policies are created to help them compete with resources that may have had a different sort of regulatory environment to deal with when they first came online. And so it's useful to compare some of the policies that are happening overseas with what we have here. While there is an increasingly supportive federal relationship to marine renewable energy, it's still sort of peanuts compared to what's happening in Europe in particular. In Portugal, there's a very robust feed-in tariff and something like basically like a pre-permitted wave energy zone. So companies can deploy their pilots, their pilot devices and demonstration devices, and then there's a path that's identified for them to reach a commercial stage. And for those technologies that are deployed in the wave energy zone, they have access to a feed-in tariff, which is something over 23 cents a kilowatt hour. In Ireland, there's an even more robust feed-in tariff scheme, and in the UK, they have the equivalent to our RECs, renewable energy certificates. They have something called renewable obligation certificates, and for the equivalent of their renewable portfolio standards. And wave-generated energy are the beneficiary of a multiplier of 5 to 1. So for each megawatt hour of wave that's generated, they receive 5 times credit. And the RECs are trading at something over $55 a megawatt hour. So it effectively becomes a market for wave-generated energy that's supported by about $300 a megawatt hour through this ROC trading system. And what's interesting in the UK is that this ROC system has been implemented, and there hasn't been a single wave-generated ROC traded yet, but the market is incredibly hot. And you see the... In Europe, the attention of the wave communities in Portugal and in the UK. And in the UK, the industry is starting to settle there. There are, when I was back in Europe, I visited 4 companies that employ well over 100 people, highly skilled, highly qualified people. And these companies are really poised to grow as the industry evolves, and partially as a result of these supportive public policies. With OWET, we're happy again to thank the legislature and Oregon Inc. For a second round of funding. The next couple years, we're going to be working very hard on recruitment and leveraging the increasing and hopefully continually increasing support from the federal government. So a lot of our efforts will be to continue to showcase the good work that we're doing in this state, again, emphasizing the responsible development of the resource. And we found that that's the kind of message that really reverberates with the development community internationally. So I would expect over the next couple years for there to be a continued attention paid to the state. And as technologies progress and as some of the regulatory burdens become better understood and pathways through it are increasingly identified, I'd expect for there to be more projects cited in the state and more investment to start to flow into the state to get these projects developed. With that, I'll be happy to take questions afterwards, and I think, Mark, you're next. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to just talk a little bit philosophically before we actually get to the presentation. It's my belief that this... Mark Labhart. I'm sorry. Mark Labhart, Tillamook County Commissioner. I have the privilege of being one of the county commissioners. This generation, I believe pretty strongly, needs to be the generation that starts to address some of our energy problems. We need to stop pushing our problems to future generations. We all know we're going to run out of oil eventually. We all know we have issues with energy sources. And I believe pretty strongly that this generation of leaders now needs to start to address renewable energy resources. Now, we've seen it with the wind energy facilities in eastern Oregon, but the ocean renewable energy is an opportunity that we have, I think, to begin, as Kevin said, it's going to be a long process, but to begin to address some of our long-term energy problems. And it's been said by many folks in the scientific community and elsewhere that just tapping a very, very small portion of ocean renewable energy could potentially provide enough energy to supply the entire world with energy. And so we need to start working on that. And so in Tillamook County, at least the Board of Commissioners there are very supportive of looking into responsible renewable energy. So I'm going to show you just a snapshot of what's going on in one portion of the coast. Kevin talked about some other portions, and that's what's going on in Tillamook County. So we'll see if we can get it going here. Okay, so what we did was we formed a group called TIDE. TIDE stands for the Tillamook Intergovernmental Development Entity. It's a partnership between Tillamook County and our local PUD. Bonneville Power Administration has a couple BPA main lines coming into Tillamook County, so we have a transport system that can move ocean energy into the grid and essentially go out into the rest of the United States. We also said early on we need to make sure we involved the community. So we formed a group called FACT. It stands for the Fisherman Advisory Committee for Tillamook. It provides a strong, unified voice for the fishing community and provides input to the Board of Commissioners on potential projects. It has 26 members. We've appointed 13 interest slots, 6 representing commercial fishing, 3 representing the charter fishing groups, and 3 representing sport and recreation. We fully realize this is just one of the interest groups that's very interested in ocean energy, but these are the folks that are on the ground, if you will, or on the water, and have a strong interest in what happens off of their coastline because of their resources that are directly affected by potential projects. And then we have one at large. So FACT does 3 things for us. They provide input to us on access issues. They spent about a year haggling, if you will, where would be a potential site that the fishing community could support. And if you if you look out in the ocean right now, it's pretty much entirely mapped, if you will. I mean, if you're not a troller, you're a crabber, if you're a shrimper, sport, commercial, recreation, they've pretty well covered the entire ocean. So it was very difficult for them to come up with a site, and 2 sites that they said we could live with this in terms of having a renewable energy site there. So we asked them to also look at environmental biological issues, anchoring. You've all heard the horror stories about the one device at Newport, there. I think it was at Newport, that had some issues a couple years ago. And safety issues, navigation, sinking, breaking loose. Crab pots tend to move in the ocean, and crab pots could move into one of these devices and cause some issues. And benefits of other issues, economic development, dredging, and related. Of course, a lot of the maintenance that would be done on these sites would be done at ports, and port facilities creates jobs. Oregon Iron Works maybe is going to build some of these sites, build some of these facilities, those kind of things. So it has some huge economic benefits too. So in October 2007, TIDE filed for a FERC, a Federal Energy Regulatory Permit, and we were granted a permit. We identified 6 sites, each a mile by 3 miles along the boundary of the territorial sea and opposite of our existing PUD substations. And the map here just shows some of those sites. And those were just placeholders. Come on. There we go. So in May of 2008, FERC issued TIDE a preliminary permit for a 36-month period to conduct what we call feasibility studies. At the end of the 36 months, TIDE must file an application for a license, and that's a 50-year license, or lose its permit and municipal power preference. So in March 2008, we issued an RFP seeking proposals from wave energy developers. We received 1 response from Columbia Energy Partners. We signed the agreement with Columbia Energy Partners in 2009. In addition, we received an unsolicited proposal and began negotiations with Principal Power on a memorandum of understanding for a framework of a proposed offshore wind device, and this is what they call their wind float technology device. And it would be beyond the territorial sea. There is a consistent wind beyond the territorial sea. It's out there. There's buoys that are out there, and they have been measuring the wave and wind energy for literally decades. And so they know that there's a consistent wind out there. And when you go from 30% efficiency with a wind generation to 50%, which is what they think they can get because of this consistent wind, you know, in the gorge, it's not consistent. And as I understand, it's about a 30% efficiency. Well, out in the ocean, they can get 50%, and that's a huge economic advantage to them. So in March 2009, our TIDE board chair, which is the chair of the PUD, met with Bonneville Power Administration to begin exploring the infrastructure needed to do this. And, of course, with the economy's tanking, as we all know, or tanked, and so there was a deep recession. So on August of this year, CEP notified TIDE that they were terminating the MOU. They said they cited several reasons in their letter. They said that the location submitted by FACT is not suitable for the development of a wave energy device. The site was in a high public visibility area, and the site would have difficulty connecting to a PUD substation, and there was financial issues. And I think the bottom one is probably the most appropriate. So CEP, we were excited about them, and they've backed out now. So what do you do? Pick up your cards and go home? Nope. We decided that there may be other interested parties who have an interest in siting a wave energy project in Tillamook County coastline. We agreed to go out for another RFP and look at some other areas besides the open ocean possibility of a jetty. And Principal Power was still interested in eventually developing an offshore device with us. We just got word a couple weeks ago that Principal Power just received a stimulus grant of $24 million, and that grant is going to help fund their research and development on a utility-scale and prototype wind turbine device, the wind float technology, with the goal of improving the performance and reliability of both the land-based and offshore wind generation. And as Kevin said, Principal Power is right now engaged in Portugal, where they actually want to get a device in the water, one of their wind float technology devices in the water, test it, work out all the bugs, and then come to the United States. So this $24 million will help fund that research that they're going to do. And still lots of collaboration to do with other interest groups. So you might think that's the end. Not necessarily so. So stay tuned. And the stay tuned is about 2 weeks ago, we met with some principals from the Corps of Engineers here in Portland, and the Corps we are looking at the possibility of negotiating with a company who I cannot mention right now about a device on the end of a jetty, similar to what is on the Winchester jetty. So we wanted to talk with the Corps about, we've just got $12 million from stimulus funds to rebuild our north jetty at the Port of Garibaldi, and would the Corps of Engineers be interested in allowing a wave energy device to be placed on the end of the jetty. And essentially what it is, I call it a blowhole technology. As the wave comes in, it raises the water, it pushes air up, spins a turbine, and that's what creates the energy. The Corps said that from their highest levels that they are very interested and supportive of looking at the possibility of placing a device on the end of the jetty for several reasons. One, it also stabilizes the end of the jetty. We don't have conflicts with the fishing community. We don't have conflicts with viewing. We don't have conflicts with the maintenance of the cable, the undersea cable. We don't have conflicts with land use planning and the territorial sea plan. We don't have this thing going out in the ocean. The negative of it is it's a small device. And so you need to look at the possibility of placing other devices that are out there. So at least we're starting the process with the Corps that they're very supportive. So that's an example of what's going on in north part of the Oregon coast. Thank you.
Thanks, Commissioner. Let's hear from Representative Boone and then see what their questions.
Now we have to find how we get to that. Do you know how we get out of it?
Escape.
Sorry,
he'll
hit escape. Okay. And mine's down at the bottom. Is that? This one. This is my first attempt at a PowerPoint, so stay tuned. Yeah. Okay, it's loading. And while we're waiting for it to load, I'll just comment on, the fact that this, we did this independent of each other, and it's all going to work out really well. I'm gonna bring up the rear here. This is my presentation is coming out of, I've been spending about a month on the road, the last 2 weeks in Canada at an Ocean Renewable Energy Group conference where I was brought up to date on what's happening mostly in Canada and in Europe and other places around the world, depending on who was giving the presentation. But virtually everybody who I talked to said they're all watching Oregon, and they're watching to see what we do regulatory-wise, incentive-wise, and they're very interested. And a couple of people, actually one device manufacturer, maker, I was able to send down to Tillamook County, and they couldn't make the stop they wanted to there, but they had to drive through there and saw Garibaldi. They headed to Newport. Don Mann, we heard from earlier today, said he met with them, and they make a breakwater and other devices, and I do have a photo of it, so I can show you what they're talking about. It's possible they could do something in Garibaldi also, and with their breakwater, which if you're replacing one at a marina, they can add for about 10% more of the price an energy-producing device. So I'll see if I can do this. And this is just some definitions of ocean energy. I consider it wave, stream, tidal, current, and I include offshore wind and geothermal in it when I define it. But this is for the most part what we talk about. There are numerous methods of harnessing it, and as Kevin said, there's probably 100 devices out there right now. I'm sure that as things move forward, some will drop off and others will bubble to the surface. There in tidal, which is, we'll call that underwater, not on top of the water, there's about 50 concepts now, and technically we're there. We just need incentives, a market, and money. And Canada has targeted by the year 2050, 4,000 megawatts from tidal in three-quarters of it in BC, and 10,000 megawatts from wave. And tidal's pretty a lot easier to forecast than wind and solar and things like that. And the wave is right there, too. But as Kevin pointed out, there's some premium for these sources of energy at this point, but the price will come down in the future. And the thing to remember is once it's built, there's no fuel to buy. And that's going to be huge in our world of diminishing fossil fuels. This is, and I say Canada and Warrington, this is a device made by a New Energy Corp, Clayton Bear, in Alberta. And the small one, the 5-kilowatt, costs about $30,000. You can just about go to your Home Depot, buy the parts, and build it. But they are now manufacturing it. They're building some larger devices, and I say in Warrington because there's this very small fish hatchery there that we're going to apply for grants to buy one of these to power it. In Ireland, Open Hydro is kind of the device du jour in a lot of applications. They have just put one in the water at the Bay of Fundy off Nova Scotia, and that was a pretty big deal. That's a huge tide there. They're going to be putting two devices, smaller devices, into Puget Sound with the Snohomish PUD, and they have one in the water in the Orkney Islands off Scotland. And I'm pointing to this, it won't translate, but sorry. If you look at the base on this, it's, and I have a little device I bought at the state fair. It's a massager or something. Anyway, it's the same shape. But they were, with this device, they were drilling into the ground or into the seafloor to attach it. But now they find they can just set this thing down. They build, when they build them in Ireland, they build a barge to ship it over all in one piece, and then they put it in. And that's the one they put in to the Bay of Fundy. There's an older version of it, how it looks. Canada and Washington State, I mentioned that. They are attracting investors and enabling these projects to move forward. The message that I heard over and over again was, as soon as we get something in the water, and I think we've heard both of my colleagues here say that, get something in the water as a test device, then the investors can see if it works or not and whether they want to put their money there. There's a huge amount of risk in a lot of these things because of the unknowns. But I think it's getting closer and closer. Norway, this is the I can't do that. The breakwater on the right there is the prototype for that. And I was not able to get that. There's a schematic that I have. Yeah, and there's a schematic that I had, and I wasn't able to technically do the magic to get it on here. But basically what it is what Mark talked about. It comes in and it fills up levels of inside the device there, and then they push it up. So come to my office, and I'll show you if you want to see further on that one. But that device maker, Wave Energy, out of Norway, they're the ones who are interested in developing. They also have a Jetty device, too. They're very interested in Oregon. They like the feel of this state and how we do business. And I'm surprised at how often they come over. Don Mann said to me today they will be back to talk with him further about applications in Newport. And tomorrow I'll be meeting with somebody who will report on the market utility initiative that OWET did. And there's a long list of elements. I haven't read it yet. I talked to Kevin about that. But I will be coming back to you with that, what I hear after that. One of the things that Oregon can do and is doing, too, I think, in addition to Wave, and just remember this, I'm not talking about ocean wave. I'm also talking about river. There's a lot of opportunities to develop in our rivers. The Columbia River has a site that was permitted by FERC for an underwater device, and in that case, a turbine. And Verdant Power out of New York and now in Canada is looking at it again. That spot is available if they want to. Now, how do you make it go down? Whoops. Anyway, there's the big thing to remember in all of this, and this is one of our goals, is to build the economy in Oregon. All of these applications will provide jobs from start to finish in the engineering, construction, manufacturing, and finally in maintenance. And one thing that we've been working with our Coastal Caucus is to look at some of the maintenance jobs to apply our out-of-work fishermen to those positions. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Yeah, this is a very interesting area for the state to be exploring. I really appreciate the presentation, and I'm looking forward to consideration of next steps, possibly legislative, on the issue. First, one question I have. You mentioned, Kevin, you mentioned what some other countries are doing in order to help move this technology along. Are there any other states that U.S. states that have adopted either a feed-in tariff or a policy under their RPS to specifically address wave energy?
There aren't, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. There are no other states that have implemented a feed-in tariff. I suppose California is probably the closest to enacting policies designed to support the industry, largely through PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. They're pursuing a project called Wave Connect, which in some ways is similar to the Portuguese scheme without the sort of feed-in tariff regime that there is in Portugal. What they're seeking to do is establish a facility that will enable full-scale devices to test and prove their performance. So they're deploying a semi-permanent sort of test berth off the Northern California coast, and they put out an RFP asking developers if they'd like to come and deploy at that site. They received some money from the California PUC that enabled them to do that. And then with the way that the California market is set up, they have the market price referent, which is essentially the avoided cost the utilities would face going forward to buy sort of the standard mix of power. Anything that's above that price is essentially subject to PUC review, and they have to determine whether or not it's a good choice for utilities to make, not so different from what we have here. So I think it's unclear still what exact price developers might get for whatever energy they generate there. In Oregon, we have a somewhat similar concept that's grown, and I neglected to mention the wonderful thing that we have happening with Oregon State University at Newport with the Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center. NIMREC has received a federal grant and a lot of state support to develop a mobile test berth, which frankly, I think is a better idea, which will allow basically a barge with power conditioning and monitoring equipment to move up and down the coast and provide the same sort of testing in an impermanent way.
Great. See if there are any questions. Representative Thompson.
I seem to recall that the wind initiative for Cape Cod kind of went down with a big thud over scenery and tourism issues. Is any thought being given in the design stages of the Oregon coast? I can't imagine people owning oceanfront property are going to be really excited about having a barge anchored off the beach or some of the beachfront land-based sort of things cropping up in their view. Now, it wouldn't apply to underwater, but are you cranking that into considerations, or assuming we're going to have quite a few of these at some point up and down the coast?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I'll start, and then maybe, Mark, you can finish up. Generally, the offshore devices will be located some miles offshore, two, three, perhaps more miles offshore. So the effect that they have on the viewshed is pretty small. Okay. Some of the devices are actually based underwater, so you wouldn't be able to see them at all. And this is an important consideration for the developers to make, recognizing that in their siting decisions, they have to meet certain stakeholder approvals as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, right on. In fact, we had meetings up and down our entire coast from Nesco and clear to Manzanita, having public meetings to discuss just that, because we have folks that's called NIMBO, not in my blue ocean. So we are...
I know some of those people.
That is an extremely important point. Not only, I mentioned the fishing community, but also the folks that buy their homes, and that's what they don't want to see as a device out there. Some of these devices are flat to the ocean. Principal Power's device can be put significantly offshore. In fact, it can be put out many miles, so you can't even see it. But, of course, it's about $1 million a mile for the cabling, and so they would like to be as close to the shore as possible. So that's one of the important issues that's got to be addressed with siting of these devices is the viewshed.
Thanks. Representative Benson, then Bailey, and then I think we'll need to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The phrase was regulatory burdens and finding a pathway through them, which I very much like. And in watching the transmission difficulties that we're having in Eastern Oregon, in placing transmission on public land is where the true difficulties arise, because of the 17 or 18 or 150 studies that need to be done before one can set foot on public land. I'm just curious, when you were mentioning regulatory burdens, is it federal, is it state, is it both? And is it true then that it's the regulatory burden that's stopping us from progressing, or is it the technological burden? Because I think I heard you say it's not technology, it's regulation.
No, technologically, people like to think that we're there. It's not knowing what the regulatory scenery is going to be, and that it's not consistent. In some cases, in the U.S., and I'm just talking about the country, different states may have different regulatory pieces, and the feds too. But to what the device developers were saying at this in this particular venue was that they need to have an incentive, which I assume in Oregon's case would be the Betsy, and they need to have local buy-in and that, which takes time, and they're willing to do that. And they're willing to do that. But the regulatory piece is somewhat of an unknown in some cases, and Kevin probably knows more about this than I do for that piece. But I think what they want to be able to do is see the lay of the land and see what they are facing up against. They're used to that. There's a lot of, I think I heard them say in Portugal there were 17 different environmental things they had to do, and eventually they were able to place their devices. They're back in port, but I think they're going back out once the money comes through. But that was probably the most, besides the money, needing money investment, because not all these device developers are Richard Branson's, for example, which we'd like to get him on board.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, that is also an important point. And at least in Tillamook County's case, what we've looked at is using existing BPA main lines. We have two BPA main lines coming into Tillamook County. And what we've done is we said we want to try to locate these devices where these BPA main lines hit the substations. And so you don't have to do the regulatory process, because you've already got it there. You just got to get it from the beach to the substation. And there will be some issues with that, but the PUD has already talked to Bonneville Power about the possibilities of going into this system. So it could be an issue in other parts of the coast, but at least in Tillamook County, that's a, one of the things we looked at is we don't want to build new power lines because the issues that go with that that they're facing in eastern Oregon right now.
We'll get our last question for Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, on the same page. That was my question.
Great. Well, thank you so much. We look forward to exploring this issue more as time goes on.
We'll have more for you at your next meeting.
Super. And with that, we're going to move on to the discussion of the state's oil and gas lease moratorium. Colleagues, I think this may be something that we faced for consideration in the February session. The current state, we'll hear from Bob Bailey and Louise Soliday in a moment, but I wanted to say just a couple of words about my interest in this subject. We have a moratorium currently on oil and gas leasing in our territorial sea. That moratorium expires in January of 2010, so that will happen. It will expire. There's no evidence that that's going to result any, you know, that there's a lot of pent-up pressure on for exploration and development. Maybe we'll hear more from Mr. Bailey and Ms. Soliday about that. But there's no evidence of that. Nevertheless, there is kind of consideration at a federal level of what may happen beyond the territorial sea, maybe opening up further areas of the oceans for that type of exploration. We have a territorial sea plan that's being updated and reinforces a kind of state commitment to ensuring that the emphasis of economic activities in our oceans is on renewable resources, including fishing, as well as potentially renewable energy work, like the kind that Representative Boone spoke to. And so I think it's important that we consider the extension of that moratorium and the perhaps making that moratorium permanent and do so sort of consistent with the spirit of Oregon policymaking all the way from OPAC, Territorial Sea Plan, DLCD, and our Goal 19, and past legislative expression of priority on renewables coming out of oceans. So with that, I think we'll, Representative Boone, I don't know if you have anything to say about this.
I just wanted to echo what our good chair has said. And this is, for me, this is kind of where I started way back in the 90s, I think, early 90s or late 80s. Late 80s? Okay, I'm dating myself. And in my opinion, I wholeheartedly support this moratorium and whatever action it takes to extend it or make it permanent, because I think that what we're looking at now and what you just saw a presentation on our renewables, that this is where this is, and no pun intended, but this is the new wave. And between all the ocean renewables resources, I think we're going to see around the world, we're going to see activity in this area, and that's going to be along with a lot of the other renewables that are not fossil fuel-based. And they eliminate a lot of the concerns that people have, and I think, you know, for the ocean stuff, there's no pipelines, there's no fuel, there's no leakage, and you know, things like that. That's kind of where I'm at, and I think that we have so many proposals for our ocean that we're dealing with is at, you know, for why we're doing the Territorial Sea Plan update, why we're doing the fishing grounds update, engaging our coastal communities. They see a lot of uses out there, and I just think this one doesn't quite, and this is my opinion, does not quite fit in. So I hope that we will be doing something about that for Oregon, because I do think we're seeing that around the world.
Thank you, Representative Boone, for those comments. Mr. Bailey, I think that you are first, and if the committee notices any resemblance in name or figure or mannerism to a member of our committee, it would not be by coincidence.
Thank you, although my hair is definitely a different color. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. It's your call as to whether I or Louise goes first. I want to give you just a brief background on the history of oil and gas development.
You will need to introduce yourself.
Excuse me. I'm Bob Bailey. I'm the Ocean Program Manager for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I've been working on this particular issue since mid-'80s, so it's been, I'm sort of the history book on it, I guess. I want to take you back a little bit on kind of the history of the oil and gas development proposal on the Oregon coast, and perhaps even the moratorium itself, the legislative moratorium. In 1964, the U.S., to back up, beyond 3 miles State jurisdiction ends at 3 miles out, 3 nautical miles, which is 3.4 miles or something like that. Beyond that, that's under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Department of the Interior under the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act of 1953 or something like that. U.S. Department of Interior has authority to lease for oil and gas development. They are required to do so in 5-year periods. They're required to go through an extensive environmental assessment process. Leading up to that, all kinds of public involvement in that 5-year planning process. And then there's an extensive, once the lease is offered, there's an extensive public comment period for actually siting the wells within any lease block. It's a huge machine that the federal agencies have for this thing. Back in 1964, the Department of Interior offered a lease sale off the Oregon coast and, in fact, did lease some blocks in which eight exploratory wells were drilled well offshore, most of them beyond 10 to 12 miles. Several were drilled out on Hecata Banks, Hasita Stonewall Banks, probably 30 miles out. None of the eight wells showed a potential for commercial oil production at that time. A couple of them showed potential for gas, natural gas. And I think Louise is going to speak to that briefly. If you look at the onshore gas field near Mist, it's thought that geologically that gas field connects up to the areas offshore that showed some natural gas promise. But nonetheless, there was no commercial interest in pursuing any of those eight wells, and those leases were terminated back to the federal government in 1969. In fact, November 30th of 1969, which is starting to be a long time ago. The issue lay dormant in Oregon, in fact, north of really the Santa Barbara Channel, until the Reagan administration took office in 1980. And there, Secretary Hodel and the Reagan administration initiated a very aggressive, well, first James Watt and then Secretary Hodel, a very aggressive area-wide leasing program to get as much of the U.S. Outer Continental Shelf area involved in oil and gas leasing, or at least exploration, as possible. And there was a lease sale. Lease sale number 132 was scheduled off the Oregon and Washington coast for 1989. And the planning process for that began in 1984, 85. I was very involved with it, as was the governor's office at that time, first Governor Attia and then Governor Goldschmidt's office, in working with our colleagues in Washington to respond to the potential for an oil and gas lease sale off Oregon. Eventually, it reached kind of a fever pitch, and at that time, Congressman Lesa Coyne and others in the Congress were doing yearly moratoriums on oil and gas lease sale scheduling and development at various areas around the country. We sort of piggybacked a little bit on that. There was a lot of concern about the fact that Interior had really not done the kinds of environmental studies off the Oregon coast that we felt was needed. So we worked very closely with the Department of Interior and eventually with the White House in the Bush 1 administration to set up a joint OCS federal state federal task force for the Pacific Northwest. And that task force, including Interior, recommended a moratorium on federal oil and gas leasing, which the White House accepted, that would delay any lease sales in federal waters until after environmental studies were done. Quite honestly, those studies have never been done. Lease sale 132 was canceled. The issue has basically gone into the deep freeze and never to come back again. In fact, OCS oil and gas leasing at the federal level on the West Coast is pretty much non-existent anymore. The Interior is focusing on developing existing leased tracts in the Santa Barbara Channel in Southern California up to about Point Conception. I know of no plans to extend any federal leasing for oil and gas north of the Santa Barbara Channel, Point Conception, up along the Northwest Coast. In the event that did happen, we've got a number of policies in place that we would certainly bring into play about renewable energy and protecting of renewable resources. It was during this period of time, however, in the late 80s, when that got the attention of your colleagues, your predecessors in the legislature, particularly Senator Bradbury and Representative Tom Hanlon from Astoria, who created legislation that established an Oregon Ocean Resources Management Task Force. Representative Boone was a member of that task force as a Clatsop County Commissioner. That task force was created in 1987, prepared the Oregon Ocean Resources Management Plan, which was adopted in late 1990, early 1991. It had no force and effect, but it did set the stage for what has become the Territorial Sea Plan these days. But in that process, in 1989, that task force reported to the legislature the status of oil and gas development and leasing and the issues around that, and recommended at that time in an interim report in 1989 that the legislature establish some sort of more permanent response to oil and gas development in state waters. And that led to the 89 legislature, in fact, establishing a six-year moratorium, which then sunsetted in 1995. That has really been the extent of my involvement in it. So that's a little bit of the background, and I'll be interested in answering any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Let's hear from Louise, and then...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. You've got printed testimony from me, but I want to focus on a couple of things. I think it was recognized that this moratorium expiration sunset was coming in January last session, and the original House Bill 3013 in the very last section had a proposal in it that got lost when 3013 was gutted and stuffed to fix some problems with the original proposal. And so there was actually a proposal to eliminate this sunset provision that's in the current statutes during last session. The department, I think as you all know, acts as the proprietor for the Territorial Sea Plan on behalf of all Oregonians. And so we have an interest in this issue. We have the potential to generate revenues from activities that go on in the Territorial Sea as well as other waterways that we manage on behalf of the state of Oregon. In looking at the statutory direction that remains, if you look at ORS 196-410, you will find legislative findings that were adopted by the 1989 legislature as part of this package that led to the Ocean Resources Management Plan and ultimately the Territorial Sea Plan. And that policy those findings that are in there make it very clear that the state was not interested in oil and gas exploration or development off the coast of Oregon, but very much interested in protecting the renewable resources in the ocean, including our important commercial and recreational fisheries that we have off the coast of Oregon, and now looking at the potential for wave energy. And we believe as a department that if we're going to harness the energy resources of the ocean, that looking at wave energy is a much better way for the state to go than to look at potential oil and gas exploration. I don't think there's any evidence that's been found that there are actually oil resources in the Territorial Sea. We do think there probably is the potential for some gas resource to be out there. Whether it is economically viable to develop that is a whole other matter. So we think looking at this issue and thinking about whether this moratorium should be extended permanently or for some period of time probably makes a lot of sense for the state. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Soliday. Let's see if there are questions for... Yeah, Representative Jensen.
Kind of question for Louise, I think. And there's no advocacy here one way or another on my part with this, but to look at the moratorium on oil and gas offshore, based on the knowledge and legislation that came out of 1989, which, I don't like necessarily to do this, but in my way of looking, I was two decades younger in 1989 than I am, today. The ability to safely manage these things today may be considerably greater, and I don't know that it is, understand, two decades have passed. Our knowledge has certainly expanded in a number of areas in that time. I would think as we look at this, we might want to consider what has transpired, what is going on, and what the risks are or are not as compared to what we might have done at an earlier time. And again, that's not an advocacy statement on my part.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I might respond to that by I've done some reading on the Gulf of Mexico oil industry, oil and gas industry, and the impacts on the fishing industries that were used to be supported by fishing in the Gulf there. And I guess I would say that while the technology has certainly improved over the last 20 years, I think there are still very real concerns with that sort of technology being developed. And I think when you look at the energy action of the Gulf compared to the energy action off the coast of Oregon, I think you're talking about two very different systems. And I think, again, I think there is a real risk. I also think it would be fair to say that I think the regulatory hurdles that any oil or gas developer would have to go through off the coast of Oregon to actually develop that energy capacity out there would be extremely difficult in this day and age with the number of listed species that we have that rely on various portions of the Pacific Ocean, the number of water quality concerns that we have, the issues that we're finding with the dead zone and other issues that are seem to be on the increase, on the rise with regard to the marine environment. I just think it would be a very difficult thing to do. I think that the hurdles for the renewable energy folks, the wave energy folks, are high enough to begin with, and I do think sort of in response to Representative Bence's question in the previous panel, the regulatory hurdles are fairly serious even for wave energy projects and tidal energy projects to get through, not just at the state level, but more particularly at the federal level, where you do have the federal fisheries agencies who are very concerned about impacts to not just fish species, but bird species and other marine critters that are out there, and what the impacts of wave energy development may be on those species. So I think the risks are there, and I think the regulatory burdens are fairly high.
It's a good question, and I think something that we, as we explore this in February, something we should get a presentation on. What is what does offshore gas or oil drilling today look like? I think it's a good question. I know one way the technology has improved is in the industry's ability to extract it from places that it hasn't been able to before, and I think that's a very quickly evolving. They're moving into areas that would not have been profitable 20 years ago, which is one of the reasons I think for us to be vigilant when it comes to our own lands and sea.
Just a little follow-up on this, and I appreciate very much your answers in response to Louise on this issue. I was a little bit interested in earlier discussions today when the subject of Norway came up, and I'm a little interested in looking at the development of technologies for alternative things from Norway as an example, which happens to be, if I understand their propaganda correctly, the third largest exporter of petroleum products in the world. And of course, all of those petroleum products literally are out of the North Sea, which is very violent climate in comparison to other places in the world. And when I look and consider from the few limited travels I've had over there, the regulatory processes that are in place in Norway are extremely high, sort of thing. So and I appreciate what the chair has said. I just think it's something we need to look at and think about. I don't want to reach an answer until I know a lot more about the variables than I know today.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pursue this concept of regulatory burdens and how to find our way through them. Does the department have a subset that acts as guides for folks that want to do something? In other words, it all too often seems to be that the department is there to point out the obstacles and say, good luck. And I'm just wondering, given this opportunity that we've listened to just before you presented, seems like we ought to be doing all we can to help. So do you have like a budget item that is funding somebody to help, or is it more in a regulatory vein?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, we serve in both capacities with regard to the territory. We are a proprietor directed by the legislature to generate revenue off of our lands to go into the Common School Fund, and we are a regulator of these activities as well through our removal fill program. We have developed, at the direction of the legislature, from a bill that was passed in 2007, we have adopted a set of rules for wave energy projects, renewable energy, tidal energy projects, should they come to fruition. And those rules follow along the lines of rules that we adopted many years ago for placement of fiber optic cables in the territorial sea. And we worked with the fishing community, the wave energy community, coastal communities to develop those rules, and believe we've got a set of rules that allow those folks to come in and get through our process in a timely manner in terms of the proprietary activities. Those rules require bonding, removal of equipment when a project is decommissioned. It leaves open the question of compensation to the Common School Fund because this is a very new and developing industry. We didn't want to set something in rule not knowing how that is going to develop over time. So it leaves that issue open. We issued one permit for the Finavera buoy, which ultimately sank as they were trying to take it out after the test. We have another application. In fact, I believe we actually have two applications in the door right now from Oregon Power Technologies for their single buoy that they want to put at Reedsport, and for a little larger series of buoys, I believe five, that they want to test off the coast of Coos Bay. So we are processing, we will process those applications as we normally do, and we will, they will also need to have a companion removal fill permit from us. We have tried to make this process fairly easy for these folks to get through. We do want to encourage this industry into the territorial sea, assuming they can meet all of the other environmental requirements. I would say that from DSL's perspective, we're a very small part of the regulatory hurdles that they need to get through, and we have tried to design our system to make it relatively easy for those folks to get in. We're not there to get in the way of this. We're actually trying to encourage it. We have a revenue motivation to do that, so we have worked very hard to do that.
Follow up, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very happy for the last sentence. The question is, do you have the tools you need to be a partner, a co-promoter, someone who can assist because it seems like a great idea, and what do you need to help these applicants get through the federal process on all the other regulatory hurdles? Do you need, can you be a productive member of that exercise, or is it better left to somebody else?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, we actually had as a part of our budget proposal last session to get a full-time person to work on this issue and other territorial sea issues, which we did not succeed in getting. But we have done some reassigning of staff so that we do have a person in our land management division who is there to help folks get through this. All of our land managers who are assigned to various counties, the the ones who work the coast, are working very hard with the wave energy developers, have been participating in the collaborative processes that have been set up and down the coast to talk about this issue and try and find a way to get these folks in the water successfully.
So, Mr. Bailey, jump in here, and then I don't want to get too far afield on, although I think there is an important connection between the wave energy and this discussion of the moratorium.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to respond to Representative Benz by suggesting that this is something you might actually want to take up at a future meeting, because when the wave energy wave first started to crash on our doorstep, as the Coastal Management Agency, we sat down one day and looked through with a number of people from different agencies, and I thought it was going to be a fairly simple exercise to map out what would be the blueprint, the pathway to through the regulatory process for a company coming in. Where's the front door? What do they have to do? And where's the exit? We found it was more like a corn maze, where you end up kind of in the middle of the field lost, and you have to help holler for help. It's a brand new industry. It's a brand new set of conditions for all of the agencies, and it has not been clear in many of the agencies' authorities exactly how to handle ocean wave or ocean energy development. And then you mix in the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and their requirements and other federal permits that would be concurrently necessary, and it's been formidable. But one of the things that the governor did to help to start to create some clarity is in March of 2008, in his executive order to the agency requiring an amendment to the territorial sea plan for wave energy, the whole point of that was to try to build some clarity of process about who's on first, what the steps would be, what the standards will be for approvals, so that we're not making this up as we go along. And as Mr. Bannister said in the previous panel, the Land Conservation and Development Commission just adopted the first half of that territorial sea plan amendment but 2 weeks ago, and it is the process and standards piece, which was developed with all of the agencies, I mean literally a cast of thousands, the fishermen, the industry, environmental groups, and I think that is going to go a long ways, Representative Benz, in clarifying what will be the procedures and standards for approving these things, because we're all interested, as Louise said, in getting these things in the water. On the other hand, we have fishermen up and down the coast who are very concerned about the impacts of placement of these things in their backyard, in their fishing areas. And we've got other agencies concerned about impacts on changing, altering the marine habitat, so you get predators that hang out in these wave fields eating young salmon smolts on their way by. It's far more complicated than it seems. But I think you are right on in your question about what's the regulatory environment for this industry. And in my view, it has to be as streamlined and as modern as the industry we're trying to attract. So that, I would suggest maybe you might want to take this up at a future date to really kind of look at what is the capacity of the state agencies to really handle these. Because right now we're all nickel and diming it, reassigning staff and that kind of thing.
I appreciate your response and think that is a great suggestion to bring this back to a future committee. And Representative Boone, I encourage you to sort of come to us with a proposal for how we might present this issue to a future committee meeting, as I certainly share the kind of direction of Representative Benz's question related to our ability to get through this, help folks get through this regulatory maze.
And I wanted to point out to Representative Jensen, too, that the Norwegian folks I mentioned came from the oil and gas industry in Norway, Statoil, and one being the father who spent 30-some years there, and then his daughters, they're, I don't know, 5 or 6 maybe. She's pretty young. But the point is that a lot of the people in this sector now, the ocean energy sector, have come out of the oil and gas industry, so they know what is out there now, what was, what is forecast, and they're choosing to attach their star to this new sector because they can see that it's going to be what is coming in the future. So I guess my comment on that is we know that there's still a role for it in the energy world, but it's fast coming to its conclusion. and maybe that's just me, but I'm Swedish, so, you know, whatever that means.
You going to respond to that?
I'm going to leave the Swedish part out. That's
good idea.
There are a number of definitions that could be brought up, you know, and we probably could do point and counterpoint, you know, on ad infinitum here. Curious, were any of the farm fishermen?
The foreign fishermen?
The farm.
Oh, farm.
Fishermen. Farm fish industry
people.
Yeah.
Not to my knowledge, but okay. You know what? That was brought up because Norway, being much smaller than the U.S. and Canada, same with the U.K., they have those issues to think about. That's just another ocean use that they have there. So,
well, I think the point was, I think Norway has gone beyond the, you know, kind of where maybe we are on that, and recognized that this is a pretty valuable economic commodity that is much better handled in the kind of free enterprise, even though the enterprise, free enterprise, is the state via fishing or via farming rather than.
Well, now that's a whole other can of worms.
Indeed. I'm going to get to Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couldn't pass up the opportunity to ask a question. I was thinking about throwing high and tight, but I decided not to. Actually, I just have a very basic question. We hear a little bit more about what the original rationale was for putting that moratorium in there in terms of the kinds of concerns that you were hearing from communities on why they supported that. And then also, I've heard a little bit about what some of the potential impacts of oil and gas exploration and extraction off Oregon's coast might be in the context of the ocean. But I'm curious, are there terrestrial impacts as well that are associated with that?
You actually were listening, weren't you? Mr. Chairman, Representative Bailey. Yeah, the impacts are both in broad and specific. The potential impacts in the marine environment are well known. We're seeing, for example, just today, the results of a blowout on a platform in the East Timor Sea that's gone on for the last 3.5 months, and they've just this last week been able to actually plug that leak. But so there are hydrocarbon impacts in the marine environment. But I think where Oregon got its hooks into the actual potential impacts of oil and gas development in the coastal zone was really the terrestrial and estuarine impacts. The development in estuaries, the transshipment, whether by pipeline or by tanker barge. And then at the time in particular, there was concern about the necessary dock space, development of facilities for supply ships, not so much tanker vessels, but supply ships and service barges in existing estuaries that would displace dock space needed by fishermen and the timber industry. Then on top of that are the concerns of the tourism industry, the recreational industry along the coast. I mean, Oregon is world-renowned for its beauty. I mean, literally everywhere you go, if you talk, say you're from Oregon, people say, oh, yeah, I was on your coast. It's just spectacular. And I don't think anybody was thrilled with the potential for both the visual impact of offshore oil rigs or for the potential for leaks and other effects from those rigs. In the development process itself, there's the drilling of fluids and muds. You got to displace as you're drilling, you know, you're forcing a bit down, and so there's a fair little amount of technique involved in dealing with the drilling cuttings, the fluids coming out, and the hydrocarbons there. So even the drilling process itself can have a number of environmental effects. The surveys prior to that, the seismic surveys, the big boats going along with their acoustic surveys to reflect off the different layers of rock below. We had a lot of concerns over impacts on marine mammals, both the migrating gray whales as well as the pinnipeds that live here year-round. So while none of the potential impacts was necessarily in and of itself a showstopper, the aggregate was such that I think the communities, what we heard from political leadership, as well as kind of from the Ocean Task Force itself, was that, you know what, this isn't a road that Oregon really wants to go down. This is not Oregon's pathway to the future. And even at that time, Goal 19 leading the way on Oregon putting its priority for renewable resources, both living and now we see it playing out in wave energy, as opposed to why risk our environment for non-renewable resources. I hope that begins to answer the question.
Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your presentation. I think we'll be hearing from you later.
You're welcome. And thank you.
Very quickly, Representative Smith, I almost fell out of my seat when you spoke because I had forgotten you were on the phone.
I'm just characteristically quiet.
Uh-huh.
Characteristically.
Given the chair's desire to be quick, we can cover some of this answer, maybe most of this answer, another time. But I am interested in terms of the impacts you discussed, and maybe other potential impacts. If we were comparing the wave energy, a paradigmatic set of wave energy projects compared to a paradigmatic set of projects covered by the moratorium, can we sort of compare and contrast the negative impacts of those projects? Is that a worthwhile exercise? And if it is, do we have some sense of is it comparable, or is it very clear that wave energy is much less impactful? What can you tell us, or what should we learn more about?
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Cannon and Representative Smith, didn't recognize you there on the dais in your Darth Vader outfit. The impacts are not really comparable. There are some that are similar. The usurpation of ocean space from the existing fisheries being one, but that's not to trivialize the potential impacts from wave energy development. There are a number of those that people on my staff, ODF&W, and folks at the Hatfield Marine Science Center have begun to really research. Certainly, the Reed Sport Wave Energy Project has put a fine point on it. There was a technical committee spent nearly 2 years working out a settlement agreement getting that project up and running. And during that, they really parsed out all of the potential effects, whether they're physical effects, chemical effects, electromagnetic effects, effects on whales, birds, fish, water quality, sound, etc., and parsed those out. I guess if I were to sum up by characterizing the difference between the two effects of the two kinds of industries, the ones from the wave energy are probably less likely to be permanent and long-term scarring of Oregon's marine environment, where there are some effects from offshore oil and gas development that could leave impacts on Oregon's marine and coastal environment that would last for decades. And I'm talking about oil spills.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Well, we're running short on time. We went over with that discussion. Really appreciate the time that you both spent on that. And we'll invite Brenda and Doug from the Water Resources Department to talk about a legislative concept that I'm preparing for possible committee introduction. I have a copy. We can make copies available of what we will send to LC. But I'd be interested sort of in feedback from the committee, perhaps not today since you're just getting it, but between now and February on ways that we may be able to improve this bill. We have worked with Water Resources Department on it. This is not LC language, but it's what we're proposing to do, and I'll be looking at potential committee introduction of this bill in the February session. And I will leave it to Brenda and Doug to sort of go over the concept. It's a familiar one to members of this committee who served in 2009. We did discuss this issue of exempt wells and the gallonage, the current statute that allows exempt wells to withdraw up to $15,000 gallons a day for domestic purposes is, I think, in everyone's opinion, that number is more than necessary for domestic use, and quite a bit more. And so that's where, given the pressures that we face on our water and groundwater in particular in certain areas of the state where that's very true. We are interested in looking, examining whether this tool is one that ought to be deployed in an effort to preserve and extend the our groundwater. So, Brenda, Doug, you want to talk us through this issue again? Thanks.
Committee members, it's a pleasure to be back in front of you this morning. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Oregon Water Resources Department. This morning we'll be providing a brief update and background information on exempt use wells in Oregon. And this morning I have with me the manager of our groundwater section, Doug Woodcock.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Doug Woodcock, manager of the Groundwater Hydrology Section, Oregon Water Resources Department. And thank you for the invitation today. I'm here to talk about essentially exempt uses, exempt groundwater uses 101, to provide you the basics for your future discussions here. And I know you're running behind, so I'll step through this fairly quickly for you. And feel free to jump in with questions if you have any. So, 537-545, that is the exempt use statute. What does that mean? It lays out a provision for uses to be made of groundwater that are exempt from the permitting process. So if there are uses that are outside of those exemptions identified, it is incumbent upon the user to get a permit from Water Resources Department for that particular use. And I'll step through what these exempt uses are here. So, in 537-545, the first section establishes the list of exempt groundwater uses. Two establishes the right of exempt groundwater uses. And then three authorizes the commission to require that users provide information about the groundwater resource, and that is a rule making. Four establishes the means of documenting the priority date for exempt groundwater uses. So priority date's very important. In Oregon, we regulate by priority date. So how do you establish a priority date for a use that is exempt? In the statute, it identifies the date on the well log for that use or other information that the user can bring to bear as to when that use began. So sections 5 through 7, that should actually be 5 through 8, establish a two-part recording process that includes a well location map and a recording fee. This last part is new as of the 2009 session. So here's the list of exempt groundwater uses: stock watering, lawn and non-commercial garden up to a half an acre, schools, lawns, grounds, fields up to 10 acre in critical groundwater areas. There's one of those in Oregon. Single, that is the exemption under the critical area. Single or group domestic purposes not exceeding 15,000 gallons per day. Downhole heat exchanges, industrial or commercial uses not to exceed 5,000 gallons a day, and effluent from permitted industrial or confined animal feeding purposes and reused as irrigation. So the highlighted items here, these are the big three. These are what generally drive the exempt use discussion. Lawns, non-commercial garden up to a half an acre, single group domestic purposes not exceeding the 15,000 gallons a day, and the industrial commercial not to exceed 5,000 gallons a day. It's important to keep in mind in the exempt use discussion that these are all individual exemptions. It's not a you get to choose one from the list. You can stack these, and they are often stacked. For example, the single group domestic, that's generally in-house and domestic ancillary uses, are often coupled with the lawn and non-commercial garden up to a half an acre. So that's where you stack these exemptions. Another one may be they may have a commercial operation in their house, and they take another exemption for that to be able to develop it. So these are all individual exemptions, and you can use multiple exemptions under the statute.
Mr. Chair, ask a question for clarification. Say you had an acre and a half garden or something. You're into raising all your food for your family of 10 or something. So you could stack that non-commercial garden of half an acre up to a half an acre with the single domestic purpose and not is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, that's correct. You get an exemption for the domestic portion. So that's and I'll speak to what that exemption actually means on the domestic in a moment. But you get the domestic exemption for your in-house use and those ancillary uses. In addition, you can take that exemption for the irrigation of lawn and non-commercial garden up to a half an acre. So you can irrigate up to a half an acre of that 1.5 acres that you describe.
Follow up?
Follow up.
So how would you address the rest of your garden then?
Beyond that 1.5 acre would require a permit for irrigation on that. So what most people would do, they would come to Oregon Water Resources Department and they would get a permit for irrigation up to that the 1.5 acre, or they, if it's a commercial operation, then they would get a permit for the 1 acre portion, or actually if the entire item is commercial, then they would be required to get a permit for the 1.5 acres of irrigation, because the half acre is non-commercial lawn and garden.
Final follow-up. And I'm just curious as to where the half acre came from, because in this day and age in rural areas, a lot of people are thinking more local in their food production and growing more. And so maybe your normal little garden, the half acre, which is a pretty good-sized garden, but what if you started growing a lot of potatoes or corn or whatever? But why the half acre? Why such a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, good question. Back when this exemption was enacted, the half acre was included in that. We're not the only state that uses a half acre. Washington to the north also has an exemption. Their exemption for domestic is a little smaller than ours, but they also include a half acre exemption in their groundwater use. Okay.
All right, well, thanks. I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No.
Representative Smith, did you have a question, or was that just an expression of illness?
Forgive my absence, but you're welcome for me not assisting the rest of you.
Yes, we appreciate it.
We don't want your bug.
Go ahead.
So a very important point in the exempt use statute is that there is very clearly identifies that exempt uses constitute a right to appropriate groundwater equal to that established by a water rights certificate, to the extent that use is beneficial. It's a very important point. So while we use the term that you get 15,000 gallons for single or group domestic, it's only what you can use beneficially. And that use carries the same weight as a certificate. So that places the burden on the exempt use user to use it responsibly, use it within Oregon water law, and they are subject to the regulation just like anybody who carries has a permit for their water use. So some key points here that I'll step through very quickly. No application is required. This is where the term exempt comes from. No review of water availability or interference. So in a permitting process, we have the opportunity to see what the proposal is and evaluate whether the water is there for that proposal and evaluate whether there's going to be interference with adjacent users, surface water supplies, things like that. There is no review process in this with the exemption. No permit or certificate is issued. They constitute a water right with a priority date. They have the same rights and responsibilities as a permit holder. It must be beneficial use without waste, and regulation is consistent with other water rights. So some important points when you sum all of these things together is that we have an upper ceiling of 15,000 gallons a day, but that is not a mandate. We often get phone calls from people that say there's a new development going on in my area, and they're going to use 15,000 gallons for each of these lots, and that is not the case, and we have to clarify for folks that that's just an upper ceiling. The concept here originally, I think, was that for group domestic, where people want to share an exemption, then they can use up to 15,000 gallons a day. The way the statute was drafted, it just says single or group up to. So there's some confusion in there, and there's a real perception problem about what that 15,000 means.
Representative Jensen?
Explain to me what regulation is consistent with other water rights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if there is an interference issue, for example, if you have two wells and one is interfering with the other and the senior user is not getting their customary or permitted quantity of water, then there is a process by which the junior user would be regulated back for the senior. Prior appropriation applies to exempt uses just as it does permitted uses.
Well, how do you apply that when you don't even know that they're there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, it's a very good question because the exemptions do come in with a START card. So newer ones, since we have the implementation of the START card, we have a START card, we have a well log. We may not know where that well is located exactly, except nowadays we're receiving a map as to where those wells are being located. But for those that we do not have a map location, it is a complaint-driven system. So we will receive a phone call from somebody who is out of water. And with that complaint generally comes a finger pointed in a certain direction. So that brings our water master into play, and he goes out and does an investigation of the wells that are located in the area. And one of his first responsibilities is to make sure that they're using water under the terms of their permit or their exemption.
Doug, sometimes when we talk about these water issues and water law, given its intricacy and given, frankly, the you know, under-resourced nature of your department, I feel like a lot of the discussion is pretty theoretical. I mean, it's about the way the law is, but not necessarily really what's happening on the ground. So what are the actual practical effects of the 15,000 gallon per day limitation? What does that mean in the world of wells in Oregon today, and what would it mean to reduce it to the proposal here is 5,000 for individual, for single domestic purposes?
Mr. Chair, very good question. In many, many scenarios, it will not affect the amount of water that is being used. The domestic piece is very small. It's a few hundred gallons a day. You know, it's flushing the toilets, taking showers, it's doing the laundry, it's that type of thing. So that's far, far below the 15,000 gallons a day. We do run into the issue of 15,000 gallons a day where you have many users who are joined together in the exemption.
And that would be group domestic purposes.
Group domestic, okay. That's correct. Then you get enough of those together and you can start to push up against that piece. Now, an important point in the 15,000 gallons a day, and this is why I speak of these as being separate exemptions, the big water user in the exempt piece is the half-acre non-commercial lawn and garden. That's where people have their sprinklers going on outside, and they may do it for hours and hours and hours. So that is a separate exemption, is not part of the 15,000 gallons. So that's outside of the 15,000. What some have talked about and is worth discussing, I think, is to meld those together so that there is a single exemption, domestic, that includes a half an acre of non-commercial lawn and garden.
And that's what's proposed in the language that we sent to LC. It also proposes that the 15,000 for group domestic purposes, including watering for lawn and non-commercial gardens, is maintained at 15,000, but it's not quite maintained because it throws the other exemption in there as well, the non-commercial garden and lawn.
Mr. Chair, this is a very important concept here because one of the issues that our water master corps struggles with is when we receive a complaint that says my neighbor is wasting water, turns his sprinkler on and it runs 24/7, and the water master goes out there and the only criteria that he has there to look at the outside watering is the half acre. And if it's measured within a half acre, whether he turns the water off on or off, the only thing he can really do is see if it's running down the road. If it's not running down the road, it's for a beneficial use, but he cannot require that it be metered or anything to see whether a reasonable quantity of water is being used. So in folding those in, this brings a volume limit on the amount of water that can be used under the exemption. So it's worth discussing.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much liked your question. I thought it was exactly the right question. So how big a problem does this bill resolve? Did you get hundreds of calls like the one you just described each year? Do you get two? I'm just curious how much work we're doing for how much effect. And while you're responding to that, the example that you just used, there would be a violation of the beneficial use from the facts you just gave, because that's not beneficial using it to leave it on all night. It is not. But the real issue is, how are you going to know how much they're using? Even if you get this bill, you still don't have a measurement piece. So I just want to know what this thing really accomplishes, first as to volume of problem that you're trying to solve, and second as to practicality and regulation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, thank you. Very good questions. The practicality of this, it's variable as far as the kinds of calls and how we have to respond to these types of things. We respond with some regularity on this. The peak, obviously, was going to be Measure 37 era. We spent a lot of time talking about the 15,000 gallons a day at that time. That has waned substantially since then. We still get phone calls, many of them a year. I couldn't tell you exactly how many. But when we get called out to address watershed councils or neighborhood associations, this is a very common question that comes up. What does the 15,000 gallons really entail a landowner to do? So from a practicality standpoint, as I mentioned earlier, this probably isn't going to change the amount of water that's used a whole lot. There could be some in those scenarios where if you're folding in the half acre into the 15,000 gallon or 5,000 or 15,000 gallons, then that may reduce it for some folks. But on the large, I don't know that this is going to really change the water balance as far as use goes. What it does is it just lowers the constraints of what the people can use. I absolutely agree with you, Representative Bentz, on the piece about the violation of the water if they leave it on all the time. You're absolutely right. The problem being the water master has nothing to really look to be able to resolve that issue of that over-irrigation on the half an acre. He and she can require metering if that's necessary for regulation, and that would be a likely result of something like this in a complaint. Be required to meter and just see that these uses would stay within the 5,000 gallons, 15,000 gallons a day.
Is it possible that by reducing this gallon per day limit, you quell some of the concern that may exist on the part of current users, say, who are surrounded by development or prospective development? So instead of seeing this scary 15,000 gallon per day number, which you've suggested is just sort of wildly out of proportion with typical use, they're looking at maybe still a scary but less scary $5,000 gallon number. Is there sort of potential advantage from that standpoint?
Chair Cannon, that would be an affirmative. I think it's easier to talk about something that other states around us use as well,
mm-hmm.
Rather than a much larger number than that. But, you know, people who are water conscious are appalled at that number. You know, they know that they're using a couple hundred gallons a day, and then they see that their neighbor, whom they have no control over how they use their water, is allowed 15,000 gallons. I think there's an uncertainty there, and I think there's perhaps a reduction in the angst in this.
Great. Any further questions? Representative Boone and then Bernhardt.
Well, I just have to say, and it was a while ago, but it was over on the east side near Yakima, so it was in Washington State. But we have similar lands in Oregon. And I watched a ranching couple, we stayed with them for a few days, go out with their four-wheelers to re-divert the water. They do it all with plastic. I'm sure you east side boys know what I'm talking about. They route it so it doesn't just run all over. And I mean, they stopped in the middle of a meal at one point to do this because they were concerned by how they time how long they let it run one way or another. And it's for stock watering, it's their yard or whatever, but their garden. They're not watering a lawn out there. And water is so scarce in some part, this was summer, that I have a hard time seeing people in that application wasting the water because they know they have such a small amount. And I think if a neighbor saw somebody watering, you know, a little garden or something like that, it wasn't a food garden, it was like a little posies or something, that there would be some sort of Hamlet-style action, I think.
Great comment, Representative Boone. Representative Bernhardt.
I'll pass. Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, thank you. Appreciate your help with this, and we'll take it up
for consideration at our next meeting in January. With that, seeing nothing further, what is the date? Can we remind the committee of the, do we know the date? We do know the date. I have it on my calendar. You probably have it on yours. We'll meet in January for the final time before the February session. Do not yet know what our schedule will be in February, but be in touch and look forward to seeing you in January. With that, close the House Committee on Environment and Water.